Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. If you'll rise, please, and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. At this time, Madam Clerk, would you please read any changes to our calendar, our agenda?
Today's agenda, items added on the consent agenda is B16, a request to authorize the Public Works Director to sign a contract with the California Conservation Corps to conduct vegetation maintenance in Arroyo Grande Creek and Los Barros Creek Flood Control and Water Conservation District Zone 1-1A, 4th District. Recommend approval. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. Amended item of hearing is item C5, a hearing to consider a resolution withdrawing the measure calling for a special tax election in the Cimarron Way Road Improvement Zone of County Service Area Number 9, 2nd District. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign. Staff is requesting that the attached pages regarding the notice of public hearing be added to the staff report. Amended item on closed session under conference with labor negotiator, number 4, negotiator name Santos Arona, Gail Wilcox, name of the employee organization SLOCIA, public services, supervisory, clerical, trades and craft, and unrepresented management. Staff is requesting this item be amended deleting unrepresented management. Added item on closed session is number 8, negotiator name is Santos Arona, Gail Wilcox, name of the employee organization, unrepresented management, and confidential. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. And those are all the changes to today's agenda.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. This one will move on to the public comment period, and first request to address is by Supervisor Lantol.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a real honor to do this morning. There's a couple in the audience that are celebrating their 65th wedding anniversary tomorrow. I had the pleasure of meeting this man as a young police officer. He was a coach at the high school for 41 years. On their wedding day, August 16, 1942, he was given his 1A draft notice and told to report to service. The first 2 years of their wedding, he was overseas as a medic. He's one of my heroes. I can't tell you how many thousands of kids that he's had a positive influence on in San Luis Obispo. John Madden gave him credit in his autobiography because he helped John Madden get his first job at Allen Hancock. And I just want to say, Coach, you and Marge, I hope you have 65 more, and I'd like you to come up and get a bouquet of flowers and give you a card. And if I could, I'd give both of you a hug, but I don't think I can get behind the dais here.
Harry can bring them up and give them a hug.
Holy moly, I didn't think this was going to happen.
Congratulations, Coach.
Congratulations.
Come back here. Come back here. Let's take a picture.
Thank you. Thank you anymore, sir. Actually, the job was very easy.
Yeah, thanks to her, things were right.
Come on over here, Mark.
Just stand, stand here.
Coach.
Stay here. Get the whole crowd.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I might add, I asked him early this morning if he could sum up 65 years of marriage. He said, Jerry, I can do it in 2 words. So I thought, boy, this better be good. I better take notes and get out here. I said, well, Coach, what are the 2 words? He said, yes, dear.
Smart man.
Thank you, and many, many returns. Our next request to speak is Mr. Graham, followed by Mr. Greening.
Morning.
There you go.
I am Terrell Graham. probably the most closely held secret in America today is the stamp in the right-hand corner of this sheet of paper. President Bush claimed that he had immunity from the International Criminal Court on June 6 of 2002. But as you can see from this overhead, I had already indicted him in the United States Supreme Court on April 10th, 2002, making his declaration of immunity ex post facto. In other words, he had already been indicted for a crime, and therefore he couldn't use his authority to exempt himself. Furthermore, the International Criminal Court has provisions that if you try to withdraw from international law, it takes 1 year before that withdrawal comes into effect. But I already told you Rule 27, which was if you are already in the pipeline, then you're not immune. So what I did was I bundled up all the people from Atascadero, including the Atascadero City Council, Atascadero Water Company. Atascadero Water Company has been charging us money and saving it. They have over $3 million in a fund that should be returned to the ratepayers, because the mutual water company shareholders are the corporate owners of the company. And the law says that after a certain period of time, when money has been taken from 1 year for contingency of an emergency, then the money should be returned. And yet, even though Atascadero has the whole Salinas River to draw water from, they've entered into an agreement with the county to give them $33 million for the Nacimiento Lake project. We don't need it. We are a riparian water company. We don't need to join that in order to pay dues to the county. I've had published twice now, once in the Atascadero News and once in the New Times, calling for people to come forward who think that they have been harmed by either the city or the county. Please watch for these ads countywide. Thank you.
Mr. Greening, followed by Debbie Klass.
Good morning. I'm Eric Greening. Last night, your health commission voted to forward to you not only the report of the task force on genetically modified organisms that they had named, but also the report of this task force's counterpart in Santa Cruz County and the report provided by Slow GE Free in response to the Health Commission Task Force report. I presume your packets for next Tuesday's meetings will be adjusted to include this material, and I'm also advising you to plan to adjust your preparation time to allow for your absorption of this material. I know not everyone realizes how much behind-the-scenes time you invest in preparation for the decisions you make in the public eye, but those of us who do know do appreciate. I hope that as you peruse all this material, you will remember that our county has 61 registered organic farms. We don't know how many local customers this represents, and neither do we know how many organic home gardens this county contains. We do know that many local residents are taking responsibility for their health by eating food they count on to be safe and by supporting local growers where trust comes naturally. Invisible contaminated pollen can destroy the basis for that trust through no fault of the organic grower. I hope you will protect this endangered social capital. Slight change of subject. Beautiful photographs of county landscapes now adorn the wall outside. I welcome them and wonder where the photographer is credited. Is this part of the lasting public art? And if so, when and where were the jurying of such art announced? Or is this, as what we now see, an interim display? Either way, our local artists, like our local growers, deserve recognition and support. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Class, followed by Bob Blair.
Hi, my name is Debbie Class, and I've provided everyone with a report called At No Cost. I am a home care provider for the in-home supportive services programs, and as you know, we are currently negotiating the terms of our contract renewal. The Board of Supervisors, by not allocating the maximum wage rates as defined in the state budget for IHSS providers, are basically not using the available funds offered by the state and federal governments, thus depriving local businesses and county government of additional revenues that would be spent by IHSS providers in the county. Page 3 of the report states that this report outlines a solution that will not only improve the lives of local home care workers and their clients, but all San Luis Obispo County residents. Specifically, this report will show that, 1, the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors can provide better wages and health insurance to San Luis Obispo County's IHSS workers without spending a dime in local tax money. 2, existing state and federal funding, money that up to now the county has failed to tap into, can easily be used to provide home care workers with better health insurance and an hourly wage up to $10.50 an hour. 3, increased wages for San Luis Obispo County home care workers would create $5.14 million in increased consumer spending on local goods and services, bring a $3.81 million windfall for local businesses, and grow the local tax base by approximately $63,700. In short, the California legislature and federal government will reimburse the county for provider wages up to $10.50 per hour, plus additional funds for health insurance at no long-term cost to the county government. Increasing provider wages to the maximum reimbursable amount creates a win not only for IHSS home care providers, but also for county government and for county businesses. It just makes good sense. Please carefully read and consider the information in the report when determining the terms of our contract renewal. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Mr. Blair, followed by David Dugan.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Bob Blair, Rural Rio Grande. That's a part of Rural Rio Grande that's in the Pomo Community Service District. What I want to talk to you about is I've been reading in the paper that there's a group of people in the Central Valley that want to send water over here and discharge it into the Pacific Ocean. I don't think any kind of pollutant ever should be discharged into any ocean because we eat the fish that come out of that ocean, and nothing should be ever polluted. But let's not look a gift horse in the mouth. This water could be brought over to this area and processed and cleaned up and used to either recharge in the Pomo Mesa or even sent to Santa Maria. Oil is brought from the Central Valley to the oil refinery on the coast and refined. The oil company, from what I understand, has one or two empty pipelines that already come over from the Central Valley. To process this water and take the selenium out of this water, you need a heat source and you need energy. That exists at the oil refinery. Now, I've toured desal plants in Florida and other places. What you need for a desal plant, really, to really make it hum, is a heat source. And in Florida, they have them combined with power plants and stuff. So what I'm saying is, this water could be brought over to the oil refinery. They could make a partnership with the oil refinery. This water could be processed at the oil refinery. It could be then recharged into the Pomo groundwater. It could even be, if it was cleaned up enough, sent to Santa Maria. And then part of the State Water Project water that goes to Santa Maria could be shipped over to maybe Cambria, and those people wouldn't have to do an expensive desal plant. I mean, there's a lot of options we could do with this water. Water is a very precious thing. It's one of the most precious things we have. And it shouldn't be wasted. And it certainly should not be polluted and put into our ocean. You people are in the position to look into this, and I think it's something that should be looked into. Our job as either citizens or public servants is to make sure that the future people have clean water and inexpensive water. Look at the mess that's going on in Los Osos, where a bunch of people, mostly to circumvent growth, screwed up that community service district, and now the taxpayers and the people are going to have to pay a lot of money. I think we have an opportunity here to maybe turn this into something that would be a win-win situation for us. It's something to think about, something to look at. Thank you very much. Oh, one final thing. I don't think there's any real hurry because as I passed out to you some testimony from the water litigation in Santa Maria, the POMLOS expert confirmed that the Santa Maria water table has 2.5 million acre-feet of water above the seawater intrusion line. He says that they could pump water in Santa Maria for 15 years if it never rained and still not run out of water. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but what I'm saying is things are not as bad in Santa Maria and Napomo as you like to say they are. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Dugan, followed by Richard Margetson.
Dave Dugan, resident of Los Osos, water warrior, vigilante, pro-growth, Republican, and a candidate for the Los Osos CSD. That is a prime example of somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about when it comes to Los Osos. That being said, Los Osos, CEQA, Dissolution, 2701, Tri-W, Ripley, SRF, 218, Fines, Lawsuit, Debts, and Bankruptcies. These words and others will be echoing in these chambers, and the business of the county may very well become bogged down with the weight and the enormity of the Los Osos Wastewater Project. I don't envy you, and yet I don't pity you. Some of you have wished this upon yourselves, and some have gone as far as to make sure that the current LOCSD board was unable to forward a project so the county would be saddled with the issues regardless of the opposition from the rest of the county's residents. It was easy to distract the LOCSD board from the task at hand and to work behind their backs so the county could take on this burden. It seems like a lot of work to create a lot of work for an already taxed system that from all accounts is already having internal turmoil within itself. Someone asked me why I would want to run for the LOCSD with all of this debate, headache, and turmoil. I would pose the same question to the county. Why would the county want to or even seek out this project with all of its pitfalls and quagmires? I remember hearing in this chamber someone say the county will probably get the project anyway. Well, you may get your wish. As for me, I can work within the framework of 2701. And if elected to the LOCSD board, I will work to put the district back on its financial feet so our community can deal with the mess created by the state, the county, and the previous LOCSD boards. But in your endeavors, don't expect any sympathies or help. Sure, we will cooperate, but we will be dealing with other important issues such as dissolution, bankruptcy, fines, lawsuits, and debts. But the sewer issue will be between the county and the residents of Los Osos and will no longer fall under the purview of the LOCSD. And armed with CEQA, water codes, public resource codes, government codes, and federal codes, the residents of Los Osos will give the county a run for its money. Good luck, and may God have mercy on your souls. Thank you.
Mr. Margetson.
Richard Margetson. I want to read from a letter. Let me back up. Thursday, three members of this board will be at, hopefully be at the LAFCO hearing. But all of the supervisors received a letter that's attached to the LAFCO staff report from Roger Briggs to Paul Hood. And I just want to read a paragraph in here to give you an example of what Los Osos has been dealing with over the years with regards to the Regional Water Quality Control Board and Mr. Briggs trying to impose his will on the community, I would say for the last 3 years at least. On the third page, talking about the alternative on-site collection systems and their viability, Mr. Briggs writes in this letter, "The cost of design, permitting, installation, maintenance, and monitoring of alternative on-site wastewater systems is high. Such technologies require a high level of maintenance, which a typical homeowner is not willing to provide." My question to Mr. Briggs is, where did he get that information? Where did he come up with that idea that the typical homeowner in Los Osos wasn't willing to do the maintenance on an on-site system? Did he do a survey? Does he have 100 people, a list of 100 people in Los Osos that he's talked to that said, no, there's no way I would do that? I think if the on-site system, and we're not even at that point yet, the Ripley plan, the completed Ripley plan isn't out there yet. The final version is not out there yet with the cost, with the alternatives. There's been no on-site analysis by the county, but Mr. Briggs already is imposing as well. I think if for Los Osos, if an on-site system ends up being much cheaper to the individual property owners, I think they'd take on the inconvenience of having to maintain it. And we're not talking about a daily maintenance. When recycling came into place in the United States, mandatory recycling, I remember my grandparents saying, oh my God, now we got to separate our garbage? But we adapted. And now it's commonplace. It's part of everyday life. I think if the cost goes from $205 a month, which the old plant was at, to anything reasonable, I think people would take on the responsibility of a little on-site maintenance or the ability to hire somebody, because there will be firms out there that would take that on. My last question is, where are we with the resource capacity study for the county? Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last request to speak on the public comment. This time we'll move forward to our consent agenda. Review and approval. First request to speak is Paula Dalak. I hope I say that correctly. Next, following Gala is Eric Reining. My apologies if I didn't pronounce your name correctly.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Paula Dalak. I am a resident of Morro Bay. I'm speaking today in support of AB 1632 for the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. Today, your board is considering support of a bill introduced by our Assemblyman Sam Blakesley. AB 1632 is endorsed by bipartisan representatives from every county with an operating or closed reactor in California. The bill is also supported by the chairs of the Assembly and Senate Energy Committees. The design for Diablo Canyon reactors will be 60 years old when PG&E's licenses to operate expire. California is aware that new seismic information, new security concerns, and the recent onslaught of very costly replacements in the last few years could still be looming in 2025. To address these concerns, AB 1632 responsibly calls for California to determine whether or not to rely on these reactors for future energy generation. The bill follows in the footsteps of the California Energy Commission recommendation that an analysis be done of the costs, benefits, and risks of the state's continued reliance on aging and vulnerable nuclear plants beyond current license terms, a recommendation this board supported in January of this year. PG&E's own ad campaign calls for wind, sun, and water renewable energy for California electricity needs. Could alternative energy provide 1,500 jobs in the energy section of San Luis Obispo? Could alternative energy provide new property taxes and infrastructure in our county? Can the production and storage of highly radioactive waste be limited to the current operating license for Diablo Canyon? AB 1632 provides the first state action in over two decades to address these questions. PG&E has requested $19 million for an in-house feasibility study of license renewal to be passed on to its customers in the next 3 years, even though its licenses to operate Diablo Canyon do not expire until 2025. We ask that San Luis Obispo County, which represents PG&E ratepayers, join the CPUC staff, consumer, and local organizations that have recommended that the CPUC deny funding as premature at this time. It is vital to our state's economy and the reliability of future energy generation that the state determines if continued operation of aging nuclear reactors in seismically active coastal zones, in light of heightened security concerns, is the path that we choose to follow once the original license for Diablo Canyon expires in 2025. It's vital to our county that it, along with other state agencies, the legislature, and PG&E, all be a part of this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening.
I'm Eric Greening, and the previous speaker so admirably went over a lot of the things I was going to say and more that I will simply say on item B8, I very strongly support this. I'm glad it has come on the agenda. This is about providing information, real, unbiased information. There are no foregone conclusions as to the outcome of this study. And I would also point out that supporting it is consistent with our own energy element, which recognizes that local control in relation to nuclear power decisions is limited, but also recognizes our interest in the state and federal decisions that are made about it. And this will help provide an information base that makes for wiser decisions. So thank you for putting this on the agenda, and please do support it.
Thank you. Mr. Jones?
Good morning. Tom Jones representing PG&E. We, too, are in support of AB 1632 and reviewed the staff report and appreciate the county's letter and your action on AB 1632. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last request to speak on consent agenda items. Seeing no other interested members of the public, I'll bring it back to the board at this time. Start with Ms. Bianchi. Do you have any items to pull?
None, thank you.
Mr. Lentil.
Yes, I'd like to pull B10 for a comment.
Mr. Patterson?
No.
Mr. Robit?
No,
Mr. Lentil, B10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another great part of this job is when you see the outstanding work that some county employees have done, and also especially a project that took several years. So if I could I have Klasha and Dwayne come forward, because I want to publicly recognize them. Last Thursday, August 10th, I had the privilege of signing a grant from the Federal Aviation Administration in the amount of $15,002,156. That's $15 million. This is one of the largest construction grants that the county has ever received in their history. Certainly the largest for the airport. It's been a project over 3 years in the making, required diligence, determination, tenacity, and just plain hard work. And the two people that did a lot of the heavy lifting are standing in front of you right now. The signing of this construction project is noteworthy, and I want to recognize the significance of this because our airport is going to be a first-class modern airport, and for a county and a community our size to get the dollar amount in grants from the Federal Aviation Administration to put a project like this together, I think is more than just a feather in our cap. And Dwayne and Klasha, I just want to publicly thank you. And if you want to say something for a minute, that's fine. I don't want to take a lot of time, but I can't thank you enough for the hard work. And it's just nice to see this come to fruition.
Thank you, Supervisor Lenthal. You're most gracious and including me in these accolades, but I really have to say that the thanks go to Klasha for her vision, her focus, and her incredible tenacity. What you see is the result of an employee who really wants to come to work and do a good job. She didn't have to do all this. And because of her vision, we have these grants from the FAA. They're all discretionary. There's a reason why Klasha was named the Airport Executive of the Year last year, and you're going to see the results of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Supervisor Lenthal and members of the board. I was absolutely shaking last week when I got the grant. I've never held a $15 million worth of paper in my hand in my life.
She was hooting in the office.
Hooting and doing a jig, and thank God there's no cameras. But it really is an incredible start to a vision that we've had for a number of years. And it actually started with a lot of you at the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments when you literally told us to get started on this thing. And that was about 3.5 years ago. So I thank you for all your support. You've been tremendous. When I tell other folks that we routinely get 5-0 votes at the board, they're absolutely astounded. So thank you very much, and I appreciate the recognition very much. And we're going to sail off or fly off into the future. 2 years, we'll have extra pavement. Thank you.
Thank you, and the recognition well deserved. With that, we'll entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So approval with the amendments.
Okay.
Second.
Oh, yeah.
Now make up your mind.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Lenthal, second by Supervisor Bianchi. A roll call, please.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Lenthal.
Aye.
Mr. Ovid.
Aye.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye. With that, the next item, Madam Clerk.
The next item is a hearing to consider an appeal by Joan Noel and Marquette Format de Sortel of the Subdivision Review Board's decision to deny a request to divide an existing 198.85-acre parcel into two parcels of 80.2 acres and 118.83 acres each, located on the north side of Almond Drive, approximately 8 miles east of the community of Templeton, 1st District. This item was continued from June 13, 2006. Recommend item be continued to November 14th.
Okay, do we have a staff member to speak on this project?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Cammie Griffin, County Planning. We're just recommending the continuance to the November date.
Okay. Does anyone from the public wishes to comment on this item? Seeing none, bring it back to the board.
Your staff recommendation.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Ovid, seconded by Supervisor Bianchi. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Any opposed? Something came out last week, and Ms. Shelby and I discussed, and this is for the information for my colleagues, as when I asked for if you want to support a project or whatever it's in front of us, if you will signify by saying aye or yes, and then when I go back to ask if there is an opposition, as what should we say so it never creates a misunderstanding. So I thought I'd just bring it up, and since I remembered that, if we should reply with the same yes vote, or when I ask for an opposition, that the reply should be no. And I'm happy to do whatever helps the clerk to make life a little easier, and probably it helps the public to have a better understanding too. So when I ask for if there are any opposition, and if you agree to say to oppose, you'll say no. Okay. Did I complicate it more than
no,
it needs to be?
Agreeable.
Mr. Patterson, did you want to add to that?
Is that a double negative?
No means no.
You mean a yes?
It no means no. I would say it means no opposition.
No.
Okay. And we'll give it a test as we move through and see how it works.
If you want to complicate it, it could be I and A.
Okay. Thank you. We'll move on. Next item, please.
Your next item is C2, a hearing to consider a resolution vacating a portion of Vineyard Drive, County Road number 5156, near the community of Templeton, to remedy an existing building encroachment situation, 1st District. This item was introduced July 18, 2006. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Okay, Mr. Smith.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Honorable Board. I'm Tim Smith, your county right-of-way agent. This matter before you is a housekeeping item concerning the vacation of a portion of Vineyard Drive to correct existing building setbacks that have been existing for about the last 80 years. The conditional certificates of compliance that were granted in 2002 outlined these corrective measures to remedy the situation, which was requiring this abandonment of about 10 feet along the frontage there on Vineyard Drive. The County Planning Commission reviewed this particular request on April the 27th. Their conformity report was approved and adopted by your board. Public Works and Planning Department support the vacation of the said portion of road is unnecessary for present and prospective public use. required posting and publishing of notices has been conducted, and there are no objections received. Findings, in fact, are that the vacation of the subject portion of road will not impair public or private access, will not affect existing traffic circulation. Subject portion of road has been impassable to public traffic, and no public funds have been expended on said portion of road. This vacation is in the public interest in that the county will extinguish certain roadway interests and allow consolidation of property interests in compliance with the county's condition of approval. The department therefore recommends adoption of the subject resolution before you. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any comments or questions by members of the board? Seeing none.
I'm amazed it took 80 years to find it.
Okay. Does anyone from the public wishes to comment on this item? Please come forward. Give us your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Jim Dummett, and I am the representative of the applicant Turley Vineyards, and I'm only here to answer any questions that the board may have.
Thank you, sir. And anyone else, please, those of you who wish to speak, fill up one of those yellow tags in the back so we have the spelling of your name on record as well. Seeing no one else coming forward, close to the public at this time, and bring it back to supervisors.
Chair,
District 1.
Make motion to approve the attached resolution.
I'll second.
Moved by Supervisor Ovett, seconded by Supervisor Patterson. A roll call, please.
Mr. Ovett.
Aye.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Mr. Lenthal.
Aye.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye. Thank Next you. Item, please.
The next item is C3, a hearing to consider an appeal by Dominic Della Pena of the South County Road Improvement Fee associated with building permit PMT 2005-03536 to construct a single-family resident on Fowler Lane in the South County Road Fee Area. 4th District, recommend denial of the appeal.
Mr. Marshall.
Thank you, Supervisor Asajian, members of the board, Richard Marshall, Department of Public Works. It's my pleasure today to introduce Scott Duffield from our staff, who will be making the presentation on this item.
Mr. Duffield.
Thank you, Richard. Supervisor Asajian, members of the board, it's good to be here. This item is, actually, my name is Scott Duffield, as Richard mentioned, also with Public Works. This item is an appeal of the South County Road Improvement Fee. It is the permit subject to the fee is for a single-family dwelling. It happens to be a second primary dwelling on Fowler Lane. The applicant, in their appeal letter, raises one main issue, and that is, I'll paraphrase it from their appeal letter attached. They actually applied for and built a single-family dwelling in 2002 and paid road fees at that time. And they feel that the road fees that they paid previously should not have to be paid again on this applicant or application. And our response to that is that all residential applications are charged road fees based on the number of dwelling units, and therefore this current application is also subject to the road fee at this time. We recommend denial of the appeal, and I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. And the cost would have been the same if the both dwellings were applied at the same time, correct?
That's correct. It would have been two fees, one for the main dwelling and one for the secondary dwelling.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, comments from supervisors? Seeing none, we'll go to the appellant at this time. Is Pena here?
Yes.
Would you please come forward and give us your name for the record, and we'll give you 10 minutes, sir, to speak your mind.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Domenico Della Pena.
If you lift that up, we can hear you better. Thank you.
And as previously stated by this gentleman, I guess we are building a second dwelling and on an extremely tight budget, and we feel that we did pay already some onerous fees on the previous construction, which is our main residence. And therefore, we should be given an opportunity to either remove this fee, which I think is a little bit exorbitant. You know, it's over $8,000 for school fees. And so that is our request. But we also want to oblige to the recommendations and the procedures of this board. So that's Thank you, sir. What I have. Thank you.
Is anyone from the public wishes to comment on this item? Seeing none. Was anyone else on your party would like to comment? Mr. Penner? Okay. We'll bring it back to the board for possible discussion and or a motion. Okay.
I'll make a motion if there's no discussion. We're looking
I don't see any lights.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Penner, these are very difficult decisions for us, and it's something that we don't take lightly. We have procedures, and other people have come before us that have said, you know, it's just a small unit. It's not going to impact traffic. It's family. There's no more cars. Cars on the road or no more traffic. So it's really hard to show cause to say, why should we, you know, pay this high fee? We collect those fees to do major capital projects, which is getting more expensive by the day. I sympathize with, you know, paying that extra $8,000. But if we make an exception for you, it sets a standard that how are we going to pick and choose who adds a secondary dwelling to do that? And so even though my heart goes out to you, it's basically a cost of doing business in today's world. So my motion is that we approve staff's recommendation.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Lentil, seconded by Supervisor Bianchi. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, ayes have it. Next item, please.
The next item is C4, hearing to consider an appeal by Eric Schaefer of the Subdivision Review Board's decision to deny a lot line adjustment COAL 05-0384 to adjust the lines between two parcels of 3,500 square feet each located at 2000 Ocean Street in the community of Oceano, 4th District. Recommend denial of the appeal.
Okay, staff.
There we go. Good morning, Chairman Ashajan, members of the board. Michael Conger, project planner. The project site's in the community of Oceano and is located at 2000 Ocean Avenue between 19th and 21st Streets. The project's within the residential multifamily land use category. From this aerial photo, you can see that the area has been developed with a mix of single-family and multifamily units.
Can you put your mouse as where the location is? Or
it's outlined in black here.
Thank you.
Here's a graphic of the proposed lot line adjustment. On the left of the screen is the existing lot configuration with two 25 by 140-foot lots. The house currently straddles the lot line. On the right side of the screen is the proposal. The proposed lot line adjustment would result in two lots of approximately 3,687 square feet and 3,309 square feet each. I should also note that the existing residence on the property has a 2.5-foot side setback on the east side, where the ordinance would require a 5-foot side setback. The criteria for approval and disapproval of lot line adjustments is set in the Real Property Division Ordinance, which requires conformity with the zoning and building ordinances. As I had mentioned, the existing residence does not meet both the zoning ordinance setback standard of 5 feet and the Uniform Building Code setback of 3 feet or fire-resistive wall. This would have to be rectified before the effectuation of the lot line adjustment. Additionally, the lot line adjustment would have to create lots that would be better than or equal to the existing configuration in relation to the minimum parcel size. Because both of the existing lots are already below the minimum parcel size, the lots would need to maintain 3,500 square feet of area. Creating a lot of less than 3,500 square feet would bring that lot further from conformance and therefore would not meet this criteria. This is a map of several similar lot line adjustments that have been effectuated in Oceano in the past 10 years. In every case, development on the adjusted lot was required to meet the setbacks. In at least two cases, structures were removed or modified in order to accommodate those setbacks. Additionally, in every case, lots of 3,500 square feet were created by the lot line adjustment unless a smaller lot size was established through the planned unit development process. Staff has processed this lot line adjustment consistently with this established precedent. Staff identified these issues early on in the process and recommended a few courses of action to the applicant. The first option is to apply for a planned unit development. Through this option, the applicant can request setback reductions and reductions to parcel sizes. Staff feels this is the most appropriate action as it will get the applicant his desired result and will not create a lot that is so overly restricted by setbacks that development becomes infeasible. The second option is that the applicant can revise the lot line adjustment to create two 3,500 square foot lots. As part of this proposal, the applicant would likely have to modify the structure in order to accommodate the 5-foot side setback and 10-foot rear setback. Given that there are other options available to the applicant in order to accomplish the desired result, staff recommends denial of this lot line adjustment, COAL05-0384, based on the findings in Exhibit A. This concludes staff's presentation. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Can you go back to the aerial picture, please? Right there. And again, if you put the arrow where we need to see, right by Ocean, so where the black box is, the houses on either side, what are their setbacks?
I actually have an exhibit for that. This shows block 26 of Oceano. The lots shown in green have 5-foot or greater setback. Lots shown in yellow have less than 5 feet, but 3 feet or greater. And the subject lot shown in red, it has less than a 3-foot setback on one side.
And what is the proper setback?
The setback is 5 feet for lots that are 50 feet in width.
Okay, so pretty much everyone is in violation, if I don't want to use the word, but probably that when those were built, probably those are old dwellings?
I do know that the one lot, the yellow lot adjacent to the subject lot, was built in 1983. It was built with fire-resistive walls, and at that time, I believe that was the allowed setback, 3-foot setback on the right side.
And the green, all of the, Cammie Griffin County Planning staff, all of the green lots are actually in compliance with the 5-foot setback.
Okay. Can we go back to the first or second slide you had up where it shows the existing and no? Yes, right there.
This one.
You're allowing, or where the line goes right in the center, shows lot line and lot B. If you divide it that way, you go to the legal 3,500 square feet lots.
I'm sorry, could you clarify?
The very first picture to my left.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you were to split the lot that way.
That's existing.
But they end up putting the house on both lots. But the existing, it was in compliance. Till they build the house the way they build it, it changed the configuration, correct?
What it did really was join the two lots together because the majority of the house is on lot 8, and it can't meet setbacks because it encroaches into lot 9.
Mm-hmm.
So virtually those two lots are together now with a single house on it. However, there are two underlying legal lots.
Okay, since we have two underlying legal lots, I'm trying to see how we can help the situation in a sense that it is a multifamily zoning and we encourage density. So going to the third picture, to my right, where it says proposed, and we had some of this discussion yesterday with Ms. Griffin, in order to make the setback from where the second dwelling is proposed, can we move the line closer to the house so that the 3,309 square footage becomes a 3,500, but then set a condition on the new piece, the setback should be the amount between the two houses on two properties as it need to be. Am I making sense? And the other one, the setback from the where it's too close to the property line, can we get input from the local fire department on that?
To answer your first question, I did do an example in which you'd create two 3,500 square foot lots.
Yes. We'd
reduce the 10-foot rear setback down to 6 feet 11 inches in order to do that. In regards to your second question, Oceano CSD Fire Department responded to this project with a letter stating that this is exempted from their fire safety plan standards, so that's all the input we have from them.
So we would need to go ask them the question of whether the 6-foot 11 is okay, and also ask the question about the existing 2.5-foot setback.
Okay. Let's suppose they said okay. So we go to the configuration here that each property would end up with 3,500 square feet. Then is there something else we need to be concerned about?
I don't believe so. Your board could find then that this situation was equal to the existing situation because your lot size is below minimum today and remains so after the adjustment, but it's equivalent or equal to what exists in the size.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments from supervisors? Mr. Ovid?
Two questions. First of all, if you did with the proposed, the parcel 2 is actually off the alley?
That's correct.
Okay, the setback on that is not the 25-foot frontage then. So a house could or a unit could be built in there and make all the setbacks.
On proposed parcel 2, there is adequate developable area even at 3,300 square feet. The problem is that finding of equal to or better than.
No, I understand that with lot line adjustments because of that situation. The other question is, what was staff's recommendation to the Planning Commission?
It was to the SRB and it was for denial.
It was for denial to the SRB. Thank you.
Now, if we were to go this route where it's proposed, where with the reduced setback, the existing house, would you say that's pretty old? As when it was
It predates our building or building permit requirements, so I believe it was built prior to 1958.
Okay. If we go where I think we can, in my personal opinion, where we can create 2,500 square footage with the setbacks, to meet the setbacks where the new building envelope can go, with the blessing of the local fire chief or department, can it also be conditioned that the existing house, if it was ever to be reconstructed or burned down, then it has to comply with the new setbacks?
Yes, there could be an agreement that was recorded that ran with the land, some kind of a covenant that would restrict the, if that house ever came down, that the new house would have to meet all the setbacks.
Because my thinking is we have a multifamily zone, areas where we encourage density, and if we and there's some legal support to what can be achieved here. But let me go to...
Let me ask one more quick, Katja, because you raise an issue. If you go to that reduced setback on the left-hand side of the picture, that could not be accomplished because you'd still have front setback if that older house went down. So you'd need to get to 10 feet in the rear in order to accomplish what you're talking about. And I was going to say, there's one more proposal you had, if you go, I think it's the next slide, where you don't jog the line, you just basically...
Yeah.
Oh.
No, there was another one where you just went straight across, where they're both 3,500.
That would work.
That won't work because it doesn't meet the setback.
Yeah,
never mind.
And that will also have to chop...
You'd have
off
to
the existing
modify
house.
The home. That's correct.
That's why I wasn't going there. I think
it seems that the proposal, the one the applicant have, if to meet your requirement of reconstruction, would then allow all the setbacks later on if they had to reconstruct the house.
Yeah. Okay. We'll start with the appellant, Mr. Schaefer. If you'll come forward, please. We'll give you 10 minutes.
Good morning, staff members. Well. I was lucky enough to buy this house a little over 3 years ago, and it was not livable at the time, so I went in and spent a lot of money and basically gutted the inside and spent approximately $15,000-$20,000 to make it livable, rentable. In the neighborhood, it hadn't been lived in for, I believe, 3 to 5 years, and Oceano's a beach community, and when it was built, it was legal and conforming. And it's a nice house. It's been rented ever since I've owned it to local families that have a child going to Oceano Elementary. And Oceano's, a nice little beach community, but it does need some work to be cleaned up, and I just feel that with a lot line adjustment. I can help the community and pave, curb, gutter, and use the back of that lot to put another structure on there without having to tear down the existing structure, because it's just, that's a little bit too much work and money for myself. I can't really get into a subdivision and a couple of PUD units, and obviously with having to tear down part of my existing house, doesn't really make sense. But if we leave it the way it is, it's a fine structure and it's nice and it's rentable and it's affordable housing. So what you were proposing, and I was sitting with my friend over here, I was agreeing with what you were saying, and that would work for me personally, and that's what I have to say about it.
Okay, thank you.
I was hoping also that you did get my letters in favor.
We have it on. Does anyone from the public wishes to comment on this item? Seeing none, Mr. Schaefer, the way we deal with appeals, that you have the first and almost the last word. Since nobody else is commenting, I'll come back to you. Do you have any closing remarks, or does your friend want to comment? Or okay. Thank you. With that, I'll come back to the board members. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for staff. You mentioned that your information back from the Oceano Community Services District said that it was not in their fire safety zone, so they wouldn't review it or comment on it. Would you clarify that?
They actually stated that it's exempt from the technical thing that we call a fire safety plan, because it's less than so many units. But we would still want to talk to the Oceano Community Services District, the fire department there, to confirm both they don't have concerns with the existing 2.5-foot setback on the house and that they wouldn't have a problem with a reduced rear setback. I also wanted to clarify, the applicant mentioned curb and gutter, and I know that, and sidewalk, and I know that that's a key issue in Oceano. And if this lot is created behind the existing lot, it is accessed off the alley. It would be a separate lot, and the building permit for that lot wouldn't trigger curb, gutter, and sidewalk out on Ocean Street. It would just simply trigger some kind of improvement to the alley adequate to have all-weather access to the home constructed there. That may be something else the board wants to
consider. Yeah, probably, because the ownership is the same of the existing and the future lot, if we so choose to do, then probably the sidewalk, curb, gutter can trigger to the site that triggers it, unless that is not something we can legally require, and I don't want to overburden the applicant and appellant who happen to be the same. But what kind of improvements can we do to the alley? Because a while back we sat down and discussed the issue of cleaning the alleys, and from cars being parked, we went back to the Oceano Fire Department to say this is within your jurisdiction to turn those into an emergency lane so no cars will be parked. But I believe the discussion was that the driveway of the any future homes that will take access from the
alley.
From the alley. Just skip my mind. From the alley will have enough parking on the property, so there won't be any need for parking of cars on the alleyway.
That's correct. This would have the standard requirement for two off-street parking spaces with the single-family residence. And we would require that the alley be paved or otherwise constructed so that it would be an all-weather surface. But we wouldn't get curb, gutter, and sidewalk on an alley.
That's true. And I don't want to go there, because that is an ordinance in place, a requirement, but only if it's facing a road.
That's correct.
In Elway, but we have enough requirements that will be as much of an improvement to an alleyway as it will be to an existing road. Yes, definitely.
Not to throw cold water on it, but I'm not sure the county has a definition of an alley. And if it's designated as a street, the applicant may have to get a waiver of curb, gutter, and sidewalk. And I'm not sure, because I know in San Miguel, I got, with that 10 years ago, I had to get a waiver of curb gutter sidewalk on the alley because it was designated as a street.
But the alleys are not wide enough to be able to put in a sidewalk.
That's
correct. And then if both sides get to that situation, you can't even put a fire truck or an ambulance through.
We've just never designed a definition for alleys.
Yeah.
And this is, I can go back probably 15 years ago in Oceana, we had problems with this back then.
No, we did have this discussion linked at one time, trying to do what to do with the alleyways and our goal, but we didn't have any jurisdiction. It went back to the local fire department, because Oceana does have its own fire department, and they have the jurisdiction to call it emergency lanes, then, which will then give the CHP the green light to tow away any vehicles that are parked and left there, which will then create a problem if there is a need for an ambulance or a fire truck to come through. But the improvements can take place. I believe the improvements that, if we go this way, Mr. Schaefer has to do is not sidewalk curb gutter, but do allow parking on his property for his or her cars plus guests that they might entertain, there won't be any cars forced to be parked on the alleyway.
Motion.
Let me go to council first and come back.
I just had one question of staff. Do we have an environmental determination on this yet, or?
No, we don't. So we would need some time to both complete the environmental determination and to go talk to the fire department and assure that there's no issues there.
And I think your improvements would be limited to what you could do to comply with zoning and building, and then if there's anything required out of the environmental.
Okay.
There's time available on September 26th or October.
I'm sorry, we closed a public comment, and I did try to give you a chance, but Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for staff. The different site plans that you showed us where you are able to not reduce the lot size, in other words, create two 3,500-square-foot lots, in order to do that, you had to violate the minimum setback for the existing residents, correct? So the option presented in the lot line adjustment method that he's showing or proposing has one violation of the minimum setback on the side, and then what we would be doing would be creating a substandard lot, so you can't make the findings for reducing the size of the lot. My concern is the safety issue when we don't meet the minimum setback requirement. And I would want input from the fire department as to whether or not they see that as a problem. Now, the other issue is to pursue the planned unit development option, which would allow them to have an exception to the setbacks. Lot line adjustments typically don't do that.
That's true. Although your board, by choosing to approve an adjustment, could recognize a reduced setback. The best way to then effectuate that reduced setback is for the applicant to record a parcel map and have the setback shown on the parcel map. The parcel map would record the adjustment, but it's a way of showing a specific setback different from what ordinarily would be required in the ordinance.
Okay. That can be done still with the lot line adjustment?
Yes, it can.
Okay.
Anything else? The council brought up the issue of environmental review, and my understanding that the applicant has done that. Would you come forward and comment on that, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman and Supervisors. Bruce Ambo, I'm a friend of the applicant, and I just wanted to point out that I'm referencing the staff report for the subdivision that went to the Subdivision Review Board, And in there it indicates, and we have completed, and I defer to staff again to confirm this, but that the environmental review was completed, and I'm referencing the CEQA exemption, and it references
lot line adjustment
that it's statutorily exempt. And along those lines, in addition to that, we did a cultural resource report that was over and above normally with their statutory requirements to confirm that it was eligible for an exemption.
I would just indicate a statutory exemption is used when it's a recommendation for a denial as a ministerial. It's a specific exemption that's set forth when you're denying a project. So I don't know whether there's been a categorical exemption done or a negative declaration with an initial study. I'd defer to staff on that.
And there has not been. This was found statutorily exempt from CEQA because staff was recommending denial. Right. It's possible that it could qualify for categorical exemption under CEQA, but that determination would still need to be made.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Thank you. Would you like a motion?
Let me go to Ms. Bianchi, then I'll come back to you, Mr. Owitt. Ms. Bianchi?
Yeah, no, Cammy? 26, I think. I was just wondering if on that 2.5 side setback, if the house could be modified with extreme fire-resistant materials?
That's a possibility, and that's one of the items that we would talk to the fire department about.
That's all. Thank you.
Prior to going to Mr. Robert, I want to turn in the few letters that I received from neighbors. You already gave it to the clerk. Does staff have copies? No. If not, why don't I give you mine and you have that in the future. Okay, Mr. Robert.
Yeah, I was going to move to conditionally uphold the appeal.
Tentative.
With the tentative motion returned back on September the 26th with the finding that it is equal to or better than the existing situation, that one, the condition of curb gutter sidewalk on Ocean Street be a condition. And that to a recordation or however the condition would read, that if the original structure is destroyed, that it be reconstructed with the legal setbacks. And then the last part of the motion would be to allow exemption for the setback.
And also an input from the local fire department.
They're going to have to do that as part of the process because they have to come back with it.
I'll second the
motion. Okay, moved by Supervisor Robert, seconded by Supervisor Lentil. Is Madam Clerk, is the motion clear?
Yes, sir.
Okay, with that, a roll call, please.
Mr. Ovett.
Aye.
Mr. Lentil.
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye. Okay.
C5.
Board members, so we can go on a short break, or we can go through and finish the morning session.
We got two more
short
items.
Break? Okay.
Take a break.
There's a request for a short break. Let's take a 13-minute break and be here at 10:20. Okay, we're back, and we'll start in a moment here. Second. All in favor?
Okay, let's let George.
Would you like me to slowly introduce the item?
At this time, Madam Clerk, if you'll introduce next item, C5, please.
Item C5 is a hearing to consider a resolution withdrawing the measure recalling for a special tax election in the Cimarron Way Road Improvement Zone of the County Service Area Number 9, 2nd District. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Oops. Mr. Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, board members, George Gibson, Public Works Department. I apologize for this item, but in our acceleration to try to get this road paved before the end of the year, we sort of stepped over the elections code and didn't take that into account and sort of set the election for a date that's not approved by the code. So this action is required to withdraw the item, and we will come back to your board at a later time when it's appropriate to have that election per the code.
Thank you. Does anyone from the public wishes to comment on this item? Seeing none, bring it back to the board for a motion.
Move staff for recommendation.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Bianchi, seconded by Supervisor Patterson. Roll call, please.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Ovitt.
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal.
Aye.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye. Next item, please.
Your next item is D1, a request to approve an agreement between the San Luis Obispo County Housing Trust Fund, SLOCHTF, for provisions of county funds to cover a portion of operating costs for SLOCHFT over 2 years, and to approve a budget adjustment and request in the amount of $200,000.
Mr. Liddy.
Actually, Chairman Sajian. Good morning, board members. Chuck Stevenson, Division Manager, Long Range Planning. I just wanted to introduce Dana Lilly, who will be making the presentation this morning. Dana is our supervisor for Housing and Economic Development Section in the Planning Department. And I'll turn it over to him.
Okay.
Thank you. This is a request by the San Luis Obispo County Housing Trust Fund for $200,000 in operating funding to cover 2 additional years of running their trust fund. As you'll recall, back in 2003, the county provided startup operating funds of $225,000, and the trust fund is just about using those funds up by now. They've met all of the performance measures the county established for using those funds. They also met a couple of criteria the county established under which additional funding might be considered. One of those criteria was that the trust fund is a cooperative regional arrangement with participation by the cities and others, and the trust fund has achieved financial participation from all of the cities. Another criteria was that the contributions from the county to the trust fund would produce better results than if the county just gave those funds to county staff to provide financing to affordable housing. And in this case, we believe that it does provide better results, primarily because the trust fund is an independent nonprofit corporation, and some of the private donors who've provided funding that the trust fund can in turn provide to housing developments would be unlikely to have been contributed to the county. Making a brief presentation. So we are recommending that your board approve the attached agreement and the budget adjustment request for $200,000. And as you see in the agreement, which is attached to your staff report, there are some performance measures in there. One is that these funds should result in construction or preservation of at least 10 affordable housing units per year for 2 years. That the trust fund will increase its lending capital from the current level of about $4 million to $7 million by the end of next calendar year and $8 million by the end of June of 2008. That the trust fund will improve its financial self-sufficiency, which it does through earnings on interest and fees for the loans, to cover 20% of its operating costs in calendar year 2000 and 25% in 2008. And finally, that the trust fund shall again match county funds dollar for dollar and obtain at least $60,000 in matching funds from the cities. There was an additional letter that came in support from the San Luis Obispo Housing San Luis Obispo County Supportive Housing Consortium, which I think copies were distributed. And you already received a letter in support from the county's Economic Advisory Committee. That would conclude the staff presentation.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from board members? Seeing none, does anyone from the public wishes to comment on this item? If so, please come forward and give us your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Scott Smith with People's Self-Help Housing, and just like to say that we're strongly supportive of the Housing Trust Fund's proposal. Sounds like they've worked out a good business plan with the county, but we really support the need for a Housing Trust Fund, and we appreciate your support of it in the past and hope you continue to support it. And just a few words about Jerry Ryu, their executive director. He's a first-class person. We're really lucky to have him in our county, it does take some startup time for these trust funds to really get going, and we need all the help that we can get in San Luis Obispo County on the affordable housing efforts. So we'd encourage you to continue supporting it. Thank you.
You know, almost had my support until you start talking about Jerry.
Should I scratch?
Does anyone else wishes to comment on this item? Please come forward and give us your name for the record.
My name is Kathleen Carley, and I'm with People's Self-Help Housing, and I echo everything Scott says, but I'm also a member of the Supportive Housing Consortium. And as a member of the consortium, we deal with people who have extreme housing needs, and Jerry has been a wonderful resource to the group. And we see his efforts not just dealing with things that are going on today, but with the future as well. So we encourage you to give him the support he needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
I'm Marilyn Mayer, and the name of my company is Solutions by Marilyn Mayer. I've been working and helping with the Housing Trust Fund since it was in its organizational stage, working to get its initial 501c3, et cetera. And I'm just so proud that we've been able to make the inroads that we have. And every single door of affordable housing that we're able to open for members of our community is such an asset and very precious. And I very much thank you for the support that you've given us previously. I hope that continues. We need it so much in this community, and the families that we help are so appreciative. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none, I close it to the public at this time. Bring it back to the members of the board. Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I'm very much in support of this request. The Housing Trust Fund has met all of the performance standards and criteria for additional funding that was established when they were given the initial funding from the county, and they have set benchmarks in place that they must accomplish with this current allocation. And I've had the privilege of working with Mr. Rio over the past year with the Workforce Housing Coalition, and I know how knowledgeable he is when it comes to affordable and workforce housing. He's an asset to the county. I know how hard he works, and I think it would be money well invested by the county to keep the Housing Trust Fund viable and operating.
I would say that Mr. Patterson was speaking on behalf of all of us. With that, your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we approve staff's recommendation.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Patterson, seconded by Supervisor Lenthal. Roll call, please.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal.
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Mr. Ovitt.
Aye.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye. Thank you. Congratulations, and we'll see you next time. With that, next item, please.
The next item is E1, consideration of a report on issues of succession planning efforts and possible formation of a planning for the next generation committee.
Thank you. Would that be Mr. Edge?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Wilcox is sick today. She's suffering some kind of flu bug, and so we wish her well and hope she'll be back soon. She wanted to make it in, but really wasn't in a condition to do so. So I'm going to pinch hit for her on this item and run through it briefly to introduce it and then have your conversation about it. So Nikki's going to run through a brief PowerPoint that we have that Gail had prepped on the item. And if we can go to the first slide, Nikki, or the second slide, I guess. That's all right. Okay, and this follows along with the item that's in your agenda, and why is succession planning an issue? The two items we've highlighted here, baby boomers retiring and challenges of replacing retiring employees. I think that most people are familiar with the general themes because it's been a challenge of baby boomers being replaced by the baby bust generation. Just brief statistics, 77 million boomers, that's the total of those of us that are in that generation. And we were eligible for Social Security this year, began being eligible for Social Security. Interesting statistic here, when Social Security began, there were 30 workers for every retiree. At the moment, there are 3 workers for every retiree, and the system projects that within 10 years, that'll be down to 2 workers for every retiree. During the 1970s and 1980s, as boomers were coming into the workforce was expanding on an annual basis by about 1 million people per year, which is about a 4% annual increase in the number of workers available. Since 1990, and the boomers topping out coming into the workforce, the workforce statistic is actually that the numbers of people coming into the workforce has been declining by 300,000 a year, or about 1%. So we've shifted from a 4% per year increasing availability of talent to a 1% a year decrease in the availability of a workforce. Now, those are just the general numbers that we see, and we have included in your material a brief chart that we got from the Pension Trust, which runs the numbers on retirees. And Nikki, could we go to the next slide, please? Oh, you already did. Thank you. And you see some of those numbers. We have an aging workforce in the county. That's neither intended as a compliment or an insult. It's simply a factual statement. And you see some of those numbers there. 44% of represented employees and 56% of management are eligible to retire right now, which means they're over 50. As you know, we have the enhanced retirement system for safety and probation employees, but the standard system, which we refer to, as you know, as the 2-at-55 system for non-safety employees, employees are eligible to retire under that system at age 50. They don't have to wait until age 55. It's a sliding scale times the number of years of service, which we refer to as 2% at 55, because at age 55 you get 2% times the number of years of service that you have in the system, but you're eligible to retire if you wish at age 50, and your sliding scale moving on upwards. Less than 14% of represented employees and only 6% of management are under the age of 35, and about 78% of employees are over aged 40. It means that a lot of people are eligible, both management and non-management, are eligible to retire in the very near future. You know, we could have 50%, almost 60% of management turning over right now, and certainly within, because they're over age 40, and almost half of the non-management miscellaneous employees. It's an issue that is not unique to San Luis Obispo County. It's not only a nationwide issue with the baby busters, but it's a business-wide issue for government. The city, International City County Management Association, which is my professional association, the largest in the country, in fact the largest in the world, it's an international association, is significantly preoccupied with this planning for the next generation issue because of some of the numbers that they are facing. San Mateo County, 2 weeks ago, did a presentation to their board in which they were planning for 75% of their management staff turning over in the next 5 years. And they've actually created positions of assistance that are designated almost as director in waiting positions. They're out recruiting for those positions as the next generation to bring them in. I think those of you that read your California County magazine this month that came in last week will see in there an article from Riverside County on their succession management activities that that they are undertaking. And also, for those of you who read the paper, Don Maruska, local consultant many of you are familiar with, we've used him quite a few times, and he runs a column in the business section of the Tribune, and on his August 8th column he talked about developing leadership talent within your organization, and that's for both public and private organizations. Spent a lot of that column defining ways in which you could develop that leadership talent. So the issue's out there. It's a general issue. It's tweaked a little bit in San Luis Obispo County, as you know, by the local expense of housing, in particular the cost of living here. It's increasingly difficult for us to bring in lateral moves, in other words, employees that are in the career elsewhere and bringing them in a similar position or a promotional position, unless they come from specific places, increasingly fewer of them that actually view our housing prices as bargains. And there are a few of those up in the Bay Area in particular. And, of course, I think, as you know, Santa Barbara County is Santa Barbara City's median house price is over $1.2 million. So our $600,000 seems like a bargain to them. But we basically squeezed out folk from any of the Valley counties as potential employees because of the housing costs. I think before three of the supervisors were on board, we were recruiting a while ago for a behavioral health director, and a very good candidate from the Central Valley, from Tulare. It was actually our first choice at the time, and he was very interested in the job, but eventually said he just couldn't make the numbers work and was not able to pursue that job with us. So those are the issues that we are being challenged with. We're doing a lot of work internally and have been doing for a number of years. The Employee University, we set that up in 2001. Working with the union, SLOC has been a very active player, particularly the former SLOC business manager was part of the original committee to set up the Employee University. We surveyed employees, all employees, both management and non-management, to find out what the major needs were for training. And that's in place, I think, as a good academic training, if you like, or classroom training opportunity for in-house talent to develop that. We use the old Army cliche, the Army advertising cliche, that we want employees to be all that they can be, and the Employee University provides that classroom opportunity. We've also, in the current budget year, in the budget that your board approved, in July, we added a position to our organizational development budget. It used to be called the organizational effectiveness budget. We added one analyst to that that budget and amalgamated into it the Employee University, the training positions previously in personnel, and now it'll be a three-person unit, and it'll be specifically targeting this development concept of planning for the next generation. How do you develop that talent? The idea being that with fewer people available, the challenges of local housing costs, and one thing that I didn't mention just to add to our challenges in the profession, we are finding, for whatever reason, and you can debate them amongst yourselves in terms of government and people's view of it, a significantly smaller portion of graduates coming out of university are expressing any interest in working in the public sector. It's not that they are being more selfish or are more interested in the private sector, however you want to define it. It's that they are significantly shifting from the public sector to the private nonprofit area in terms of there's a similar number still interested in providing what might be called service to the community, but a big shift. The number compared to 20 years ago has more than halved in terms of percentage of people saying they were considering or would consider a career in the public sector. So we're trying to tackle that issue, and we've developed these various processes. So let's go to the next slide, Nikki. How do we do it? When we got into the current brouhaha with the Civil Service Commission, one of the things that you generated out of that was a proposal from Supervisor Bianchi to establish this committee to look at civil service rules and how they may or may not be helpful or hindering to succession planning. The civil service rules, I think, are a small part of this particular issue. That there may be interpretation of the rules that is subject to debate. There may be the way some of the rules are written that's subject to debate, and you can kind of go up the level. Or it may be that some of the language of the civil service ordinance, the personnel ordinance that controls everything else, which was subject to a vote of the people, maybe some of that language is problematic. That's an issue that certainly is a part of the process, but only a part. It's a relatively small part. And the other big issue that we have in terms of overriding rules is the prevailing wage ordinance, and how does that help or hinder what we're trying to do? In some respects, it was put in place, and it is served as a kind of guarantee of stability, essentially. It says a person working for this county knows that their salary will reflect the average of a group of comparable employment arenas. So we, as you know, we take a number of comparable counties and we take the average and the change in average compensation, and that's what we use in general terms to set salaries in this county. And that provides for stability, but it also, on the flip side, and potentially with a lot of changes in the way we're recruiting and perhaps the competitiveness of recruiting people into the organization, it also limits our ability to increase salaries, targeting particular careers or particular professions within that broad spectrum of folk that work for us in the broad variety of responsibilities that we have as a county government. There's a downside to say we can't pay more than this average. That how it may be difficult to recruit people in particular areas. We're already seeing that in several of the professions. One of the notable ones just came up this week is public health nurses, where we're now, when we get a person who's interested in a public health nurse job, we are routinely authorizing the departments to hire at an advanced step in the range, simply because that brings them into at least some competitive salary level compared to other employers in the area, specifically a place like California Men's Colony in the public side, and the hospitals for general nursing in the private sector. So we think that if you're going to pursue the committee idea, and you've indicated you want to do that, that you should think about expanding the brief or the charge of the committee, making it a larger committee than that you initially took a look at quickly. And the item in your agenda addresses this. We see some of them on the chart right now. It's really a planning for the next generation steering committee. How are we going to, as an organization, plan for, in a proactive fashion, the next generation of employees, both management and non-management, safety and non-safety, that we will need to bring into this organization and need to bring in large quantities fairly quickly according to the age data that we provided. We think it would be a good idea to look at a committee to develop a comprehensive list of strategies and recommendations to address that challenge. We talk in a little more detail about that within the agenda item, doing a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats of the challenges related to recruitment and retention of employees, employee survey to perhaps get a better sense, obviously without any commitments on their part of when people are thinking of retiring. Do we have opportunities we've already developed, as you know, a drop plan that allows for people to specify a retirement date and come back and work in the meantime without impacting the pension issue? What's the opportunity for part-time work? Can we expand our rules, change our rules to allow for part-timers, and so on and so forth? I won't get into any more of that compared to what's in the detail there. Let's go to the final slide, Nikki, if we can. In keeping with this idea of a broader brief, the issue being much broader than civil service rules, I should add, and I think your board's aware, we've talked about it since, that we already have a process in place to deal with the day-to-day, or if you like, year-to-year issues of civil service rules. It's been in place for a long time. We, the department heads, talk them through with the personnel director, who talks them through with the civil service commission, and then there's a meet and confer process over those rules that that goes on an annual basis. So we think that ongoing operational piece is already in place and doesn't need an additional committee to talk about it. This committee then will be a broader committee, and the membership here is what Gail is suggesting. There's no magic to it, but you see the basic concepts there of one or two members of the board, representative of the CAO, the personnel director, five department heads split between the electeds and the appointeds, and then employee association representatives, the Management Confidential Issues Committee, that's MCIC. The chair of that committee would be there on behalf of the unrepresented mid-management folk, and then each of the employee associations, if they're interested, would have a seat at the table, along with one or two members of the Civil Service Commission itself, because they are, I think, key players in this whole process. The employee association, somebody had asked me, who are the six formally organized associations with whom we bargain? SLOSIA, obviously, is a big one. The Deputy Sheriff's Association, the other well-known one. The probation officers are a separate organization. The District Attorney Investigators are a separate bargaining unit. County Counselors Association is a separate bargaining unit, and the Deputy DA's Association is a separate unit. So those would be the six associations. And I don't know, I won't put either of my colleagues next to me on the spot, I don't know of the smaller committees whether they would be interested in having a person sit on this type of committee or not. They may be. I think we should certainly offer them the opportunity, and they can decide whether it's something they want to commit the time to. And then final comments in there, we'd also propose that a use of an external facilitator would perhaps be useful with this kind of a committee. I'm not advocating for the particular individual, but as a Don Maruska type professional can be useful in pulling these kind of committees together when you have obviously likely different opinions in the mix. And we can provide some funding for that, because we haven't yet recruited the analyst that I mentioned at the opening, and we could delay hiring that analyst to provide what we assume would not be a huge amount of money to provide for a facilitator. And with that, let me stop and leave it for questions that you may have. I think that gives you an overview of where we want to go.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Edge. Any comments or questions from supervisors? Mr. Patterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to quickly say before we open it to public comment that I in no way see this as an assault on the Civil Service Commission. There were some issues that came up out of some discussion with the Civil Service Commission, but I think this effort is long overdue in terms of taking a look at our county's future employees. And I think this committee idea is good. It does have a broad cross-section of representation, and that we should move forward with it, because certainly succession planning, if you just look at the numbers, it's something that we do need to pursue vigorously. And I think it's unfortunate that we've had the issues raised that brought us to this point, but sometimes in this busy world it takes that kind of thing to get the issue to bubble to the surface where we can act on it. So I'm looking forward to hearing the conversation from the public.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Ms. Bianchi?
Well, I would just like to reiterate that there was never any intent or an assault on the Civil Service Commission or the commissioners who are here today. Although it's been said that you should never pick a fight with a newspaper or with somebody who buys printer's ink by the barrel, you know, my initial aggravation was, well, the media gets angry at county government. At that particular point in time, I was kind of angry at the media. That's all.
Thank you. With that, let me go to the public. First request to speak, Mr. Jay Salter. If you come forward, please give us your name for the record.
I'm Jay Salter, a member of the Civil Service Commission.
Mr. Salter, let me interrupt you for a second. If anybody else wishes to comment after Mr. Salter, please fill out one of those request forms, the yellow pages in the back will be appreciated. With that, we'll start the time over, please, Mr. Salter. Thank you.
Chairman Akejian, honorable supervisors, my friend Jim Patterson hand-delivered a copy of Ms. Wilcox's recommendations to me to be sure I received it. So I feel obliged to respond by reading this prepared statement on behalf of the Civil Service Commission. In her recommendations, Ms. Wilcox advances the theory that an employee recruitment crisis has emerged. I challenge that notion. Ms. Wilcox cites pension trust figures to show that a large percentage of county employees will soon retire. From this, she concludes that a recruitment crisis may already be upon us. However, she cites no hard evidence to support that claim. Apparently, she expects you to make the same leap of logic that she's made, that because a retirement wave is breaking, a recruitment trough is sure to follow. But when I look around, I see housing developments springing up like star thistle everywhere. Clearly, our county's population is dramatically expanding. From such evidence, it's logical to conclude that a large pool of qualified employees may already exist out there in San Luis Obispo County. But apparently no effort to survey this likely pool for possible job applicants has been made. Otherwise, Ms. Wilcox would have mentioned that in her report. Let's cut to the chase here. Everyone knows that the County Administrative Office and the Civil Service Commission is at loggerheads over this issue of employee recruitment. Specifically, the CAO has tried to create a new position in the Human Resources Department and fill it with a pre-selected candidate who he believes is the most qualified for the job. However, the Commission has suggested that this sort of job recruitment might breach civil service rules. The Commission holds this view because one of the primary purposes of the merit system is competitive recruitment to ensure appointment of the most qualified candidate. Let's recall what prompted this proposal for a recruitment process committee. It was the Commission's questioning of why no competitive recruitment for the Deputy Director HR position was being offered. In answer to that, the CAO justified his pre-selection of a particular person by declaring a need for succession planning due to a recruitment crisis in the form of a lack of qualified candidates. Yet he failed to seek the most qualified candidate through competitive recruitment. Had he done so, and had that recruitment failed to produce a qualified pool, the board might then have the hard proof that appears lacking in support for this proposal. There may be a need for a recruitment committee, but one exclusively focused on where there is a recruitment on whether there is a recruitment crisis that has actually emerged or will in the immediate future.
Mr. Salter, how much more time would you need? Because
one paragraph.
We usually give 3 minutes, and I'll have you take a little more than that.
As it is now, Ms. Wilcox's recommendations, though certainly well-intentioned, appear to put the cart before the horse. We do, however, appreciate and wish to thank the board for including civil service commissioners on the committee. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Anyone else wishes to comment on this item, please come forward. Seeing none, close it to the public at this time. Bring it back to supervisors. Ms. Bianchi.
Well, yes, on the subject of succession planning, I see our planning director, Mr. Holanda, in the audience, and I'm wondering, I know that he and I have discussed succession planning frequently in the past. And I'd like to hear his comments, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Vic Hollanda, Director of Planning and Building. As you all know, Ms. Beck, the Assistant Director, will be leaving the organization within the next 6 to 7 months. Before that, we had other vacancies within the department, and we did recruit openly. And as probably some of you know, the candidates who met the qualifications, minimum qualifications, the ones we wanted, in particular, there were some folks from Southern California and Northern California, Central Valley. Unfortunately, after offering the position to these folks, they declined because of housing cost, cost of living. We then had to, and with professionalism, I should underscore that, recruited internally, and I think we did, we made a great choice of the folks who are filling in behind some of the positions. The concern that both Ms. Beck and I have, because I too will be leaving probably within 36 months, is the succession planning for the management and operations team. We have a young workforce, and we also have a workforce of veterans. But some of those veterans, as the statistics point out, as Mr. Edge pointed out, they're going to have to make some hard choices. Are they going to stay or retire? That's the dilemma that we're facing. The applications, as they come before the Planning Commission, as well as the Board of Supervisors, as you see every week, the young-looking faces before you, and as also you see what most, both Ms. Beck and I have allowed, is our senior management folks to, as we call, sit in the first chair and start making representations on behalf of the department. We're doing this because we know we're leaving. We're doing this because we know some of the management team will not be here and that we're preparing the next generation, if you will. It concerns us because, as I just indicated earlier, the recruitment process for professional planners coming to this area is extremely difficult. I think if you check with the city of San Luis Obispo, Paso Robles, Arroyo, et cetera, Atascadero, they're going to be facing the same problems. I meet with the planning directors every month, and as I look around the table, those folks are as maybe as old as I am or older, and they're going to be leaving. So I think it's a common problem, and I think that by anticipating this issue of filling the gap and succession planning, I think it's the right move, and I think that it's the best proactive move this county can take right now. I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
I have one.
Please, Ms. Miyake.
Would you consider being on the committee?
Absolutely. I would.
You know, I'm a fan.
Because, again, both Ms. Beck and I have already practiced this thing called succession planning for over a year, and I would like to share my experience with the committee. Thank you.
Anything else, Ms. Miyake?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollanda. Mr. Ovid?
Thank you. I guess I'm going to start off by saying I'm somewhat disappointed, Mr. Salter, in your presentation to kind of take a knife and reopen the wounds when we basically are trying to sit here and to resolve an issue that we have been discussing. I know personally I've been discussing this for over 2 to 3 years in terms of turnover. I'm also disappointed that you have not taken the time to kind of look like we have on a day-to-day basis. Mr. Hollanda only brings up one case, but when you look at Public Works and you look at all our other departments and see the amount of turnover internally that's been going on, to see the issues that we have in terms of hiring. And I think recruitment is going to be a crisis. And I don't want to use the term of putting one's head in the sand, but if we don't start looking at this early enough, then we're caught behind. And a couple other things that I just want to bring up is that because we're building houses doesn't necessarily we're not also creating new jobs. And I think if you look at the economic reports, you'll see in this county both of those are increasing. And we do have tremendous amount of what you call transit from outside the area that are also moving in this area because of housing issues. Now, One of the points I wanted to bring up, because it's been said a couple of times, this board hired the CAO. And I happen to be the privilege to be on the board at the time when we hired it. I'm not sure all were here. We did a few things when we hired the CAO. We set goals and objectives. And we said, you will obtain these or you will not be with us because he's at will. A few of those things that we asked to be done, one was to change our budget. We've gone from a zero-based budget to a results-based budget. That took 10 years or 8 years, probably even still more. We did it for one reason, because we need to know what's happening with the dollars we're spending. We need to know it now. We can't wait till after the fact to find out. We went through department restructuring. We went through management audits because the system that we had, the antiquated system that we had, wasn't working. And we're still trying to improve that. And I think it's been very difficult to try to put that across to the public, to other people, that this is what the challenge is that we've put out there. Now, the last one we've got has been succession planning. This is not a new issue. It's been going on. And there is a recruitment issue, because go ask the sheriff who he has to compete with in order to get deputy sheriffs or correctional officers. Go out and look amongst the field when you're trying to find social workers and other people to fill these things that you require through the civil service rules, these forms and levels of requirements to be hired. They're becoming more and more increasingly difficult to find those internally here. I also love it because I spent a number of weeks in the hospital. Go ask the hospital how come they're having so much trouble finding registered nurses. And yet we're competing with that same job base and trying to find health nurses and other things that was mentioned before. I think the issue that we want to do with this committee is to sit down and let's look at what is antiquated, what needs to be adjusted, what do we need to fix. This is not a him and they or us and we. It is this county's issue that we're going to have to come up with. As many of these members of this board may not be here 5 years from now, a new group's going to come in and they're going to have to face the facts that we are going to give them. And I don't think the attitude of let's reopen old wounds and let's start stabbing again is a solution to the situation. I think we have to sit down and find where is the problem, what is the problem, identify it, recognizing the problem with a solution, and then be able to reanalyze it 3 to 4 years from now to say, is that the best direction we went? And that's the attitude I think we should have.
Thank you. With that, Mr. Patterson, followed by Ms. Bianchi, and then Mr. Lentil. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say that we're exposed to a lot more than just what comes before us at our Tuesday meetings. We do talk with department heads. We hear from people within the department, but we also hear from the private sector as well and the issues that they're having regarding recruitment. And it doesn't end in one element and not transfer over into the other. I think employment recruitment is difficult here because of cost of living throughout the private and public sector. We hear continuously about problems in education and problems in public health and social services, finding qualified and capable people that can afford to live here. And the problem isn't intuitive. We may not have hard numbers in every case, but it's a real problem. And talking with the other department heads, since I've been on the board 19 months, I hear from several of them that they're going to be phasing out and we need to be thinking about the future. And this is an effort to do that. And while we may not have the hard numbers now, I think that one of the charges of this committee will be to obtain those hard numbers. So we need to know where we need to focus our efforts most immediately. We have very general information that was presented to us this morning from Pension Trust. We have a large category of miscellaneous employees. I would like to see that broken down into the larger departments so we know where planning and building is. We know where public works and general services and the health agencies stand relative to their management and the issue of losing some of that top management in their very near future, so we can focus our efforts on that. And I do think it's time that we move forward with this. I certainly don't want to wait until it becomes a crisis before we act, and I think this is preemptive strike and heading off an employment crisis in the county.
Thank you. Ms. Bianchi?
Yes, relative to the quote, lack of information in the, or lack of data in the agenda this morning, I had, from the time that I recommended that we form a committee, I had several, I forget how many, conversations with Gail Wilcox on the makeup of the committee and what the direction should be. And basically, this is what we came up with, was the committee. I guess when you're so involved in a problem such as succession planning, it doesn't occur to you that other people don't recognize that there is a problem there. And I suppose we could have padded the agenda with lots of extra data, but it didn't really seem necessary because we deal with this all of the time. And I would like to make one last comment that, you know, several times over the last almost 8 years, you know, I will get an idea in my head and I'll say, you know, what I really want to do is, and to some department head, sometimes Mr. Edge, sometimes other, department heads, and they'll look at me and say, well, you can't do that. You know, it's illegal, or it doesn't follow the protocol, it doesn't follow the process. Sending up a trial balloon on an idea is not an accomplished fact. It's simply sending up a trial balloon. And I know one time I wanted to recommend to Cal Poly that they dismiss every college student that was arrested during a riot, and Mr. Edge reminded me that you are innocent until proven guilty. But, I mean, my daughter's a police officer, and they were throwing bricks at her, so I got a little hot under the collar. He reminded me of the law. So, with that, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Supervisor Lenthold, and we'll go back to Mr. Edge.
Did Mr. Edge want to go first?
No.
Would you like?
Okay.
I thought you wanted to go first.
No. Mr. Lenthold, you go first.
Sure. I support the succession planning, and I want to use an analogy that I hope people don't overreact. I look at this as like a hurricane. Okay, we have the potential to have a problem here if we don't prepare for the future. We know something's out there. We certainly don't have all the scientific data, but we definitely know that it's headed this direction. So our challenge, my challenge from my perspective is to look at this and assemble all this information and say, how are we best able to address this? The specifics will become developed as, just like in a hurricane, it gets closer, we'll know the direction of where it's going to go on land, what the wind speed are, how many people are going to retire. And I often say this, but this literally is a classic case of a work in progress. Because we won't know all the specific numbers until people come to the table and say, I'm going to give you my 6 months notice, Mr. Land. I want this or I want that. So it is obviously premature and inappropriate to try to come up with some initial data to justify what you're trying to do because we know something's out there. I fully agree that we're going to see turnover in the next 5 years like this county has never seen before. So if you agree with that concept, or even if you disagree with that concept, I guess, you say, what do you want to do to address that? And therein lies the truth. We're here. We know where we want to be going. How are we going to get there? What are going to be some of our goals and objectives to do this? And I think after my colleague, Supervisor Bianchi, made this statement earlier that we need to form this committee, that I'd like to be a part of that because I do see the need for this. I have friends in the Sheriff's Department. We have 10 vacancies right now on the last list. They got one person that made it through the whole process. Now, it's a very labor-intensive and arduous process. So if we got one deputy hired because of our candidate selection, you start with over 100, you have the written test, the oral interviews, the assessment, the background, things of that nature. To me, that speaks well to how difficult it is to hire people. And I disagree with the comment that we're building houses all over the place. I don't think we're having that much growth. And the people I talk to still say the number one problem is if I come to work for the county or the city or come to San Luis Obispo, my standard and lifestyle changes significantly. I either make the same amount of money or maybe a little bit less, but it costs me much more to live here because of our housing. And so those are things that we have minimal amount of control over, but we certainly can deal with how do we encourage more people to go through our university process, how do we encourage the people to submit applications, and how do we make it more timely, because I am very, very concerned if we do not change our attitude or business as usual practice that we're going to be farther behind the curve in hiring folks, and that just doesn't sit well.
Thank you, Mr. Edge, and Ms. Bianchi.
So I'd like to apologize if we created the impression for Mr. Salter that we have a recruitment crisis. Right, I don't think we do have a recruitment crisis. A number of our colleagues have professed a recruitment crisis. I think that we as an organization, if we don't plan for the future, will be facing a recruitment crisis within, say, 5 years. I'd be delighted if Mr. Salter's speculation was accurate, and in fact, there's plenty of people out there that are qualified and interested in applying for jobs with the county as they open up. That would be terrific. I just don't see what's unique about San Luis Obispo County that is going to make us different in that respect from everybody in the business that is talking about the issues that they have. Are we different in some way from San Mateo County? Are we different in some way from the city of Fresno? Are we different in some way from, you name it, county or city? It's just the law of statistics, recognizing that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. The stats show that, as I outlined at the beginning, the numbers of available workforce are going down because of baby boom, baby bust realities. The number of people expressing an interest in the public sector as an employment base are going down precipitously compared to 20 years ago. Those translate into challenges for us. This is not, at least my idea of the proposal, is not that we create a system in which you will only recruit internally for senior positions that open up. You know, this is not a let's hire somebody in from university and plan on them working their way up through the organization and becoming the department head in due course, I mean, from planning trainee to Vic's position. I think what we're interested in is having an opportunity for all of our employees to fully develop their potential. And so they are there as a competitive candidate for a vacancy. So if you take my planning analogy, this person comes in from Cal Poly, where we're currently trying to steal them before they realize that 10 people sharing a house is not a normal way of life. We catch them then, and they don't mind working for the average salary. And as they work their way through the organization, we train them. We train them. They've got that basic planning knowledge. We give them professional training to become more proficient planners. We also give them the training to become lead workers or supervisors or managers or leaders. And they have that opportunity through the employee university. We'd like to be able to provide that opportunity for them through stretch assignments, in what would be out-of-class work that they can do, and have that out-of-class work as an experience that counts for future promotion. Ultimately, your board recruits, say, for a department head. I don't think we envisage having a system that says you can only recruit from inside. We have a system that says you may have an inside person that you're absolutely committed to, and it's a slam dunk, and you recruit them, and that's fine. You may also have a feeling because better the devil you know than the devil you don't. You may also have a feeling that this particular assistant department head is someone that has shown they're not the person we want to be the director. Therefore, we will go out into the open market and see what we can bring in from elsewhere. Since you recruited me in 1998, including me, you've recruited 10 or 11 department heads, and you're actually on a 50-50 internal, external recruitment right now. Half of them have been internal appointments, half of them have been external appointments. We've had a session, in fact, Don Maruska facilitated a session for General Services, part of that, of where they're going in the next few years, and part of that issue was retirement planning, because Dwayne and some of his senior colleagues are at a level where they could walk out the door today with a very comfortable retirement. And that wasn't about saying, okay, who do we have inside that we're going to designate as the next director or the next assistant or the next division head. It was a lengthy discussion that they had with Mr. Maruska that focused on what do we need to do internally to facilitate these people developing skills that would be of use and make them more competitive when a higher vacancy opened up. And I think that's what we would look to this committee to offer in terms of recommendations to the board, which may or may not result in the board looking to change some things or recommending to the Civil Service Commission that rules or interpretations be changed there. And that really is way down the road. It's essentially a question of perhaps addressing Mr. Salter's concern. What is the issue? Is there an issue? If we find that we are indeed unique as a public sector employer and we don't have an issue, we have lots of people available for lots of jobs externally, so then perhaps the committee packs up and goes home and says, come look at us, public sector, because we've got it right. Now, you know, that would be terrific, because I think it's extremely unlikely, but that would be one result of the committee, and that's fine. But assuming that that's unlikely, then I think the committee needs to look at what are the issues, what's the data, both in general, in the business, and internally, and what steps, if any, can the county take to address the issue so that 5 years from now you don't have an employment crisis.
Mr. Bianchi.
Well, if there's no more comments?
No, there is.
There is? Well, I was going to make a motion, so I'll wait until after the comment.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that there's anything we can necessarily do about it, but I just want to comment that we haven't heard from any of the employee organizations, haven't gotten feedback from them as to whether or not they feel this is a worthy effort. Certainly they're an integral part of, or would be an integral part of this committee, and I'm curious to know. I know there are some people in the audience that might be able to shed some light on that, and we haven't heard anything, so I just wanted to acknowledge that fact.
Well, there are yellow forms in the back of the room that they could have filled out and made comments on, so
we assume.
With that, I would make...
Let me, Ms. Bianchi, before we go to that point, I did hear from some at my office, but I want to treat the civil commissioners as a department of this organization, so I want to go back to you, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any last final comments you would like to make at this time. None? Okay, thank you. With that, Ms. Bianchi?
Yeah, I would make a motion that we give staff direction to form a... planning for the next generation committee with made up of the steering committee membership that's in the agenda, and that including one volunteer so far, Mr. Hollanda, and
I volunteer.
And Mr. Lenthal has volunteered. Since I won't be here, I'm not going to volunteer. Mr. Okay. Leib has volunteered.
And Mr. Patterson.
So, and also that there be a facilitator. I think that's an excellent idea to initiate a committee with such diverse, well, maybe not. I think the objective of everyone here is exactly the same. The methods of how to get there may differ. So I think a facilitator would be a good idea.
Second.
Okay.
You choose. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I stick to my right. for this one, I had some Mr. Lentil first. It's a motion made by Supervisor Bianchi, seconded by Supervisor Lentil. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd just like to add that I think part of that, by having a facilitator come in, that will literally take what I use as a temperature check of our employees. We'll find out where we're at.
We're doing that now.
What are some of the things? We're doing that now. Yeah. But we're able to capture this data, see what's changed from, I think, 2 years ago or 3 years ago when we've done that. I mean, we're on this course. Are we on the right course? Are we going forward? Are we treading water? What are we doing? And I think by having that information available to the committee, it's going to allow them to make the best decisions and choices of how do we make the whole process better. And I think that's what everyone's goal is, really. Not necessarily how we get there. We may not always agree, but we're trying to make something better.
Do we have that fund available in the organizational development, Mr. Edge? Okay. With that, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, it's unanimous to move forward. With that, we want to go to
closed session.
Does anyone from the public wishes to comment on the closed session? Seeing none, Mr. Orton? I'm trying to use six more minutes here.
I can see there are two meetings in closed sessions with the labor negotiator, and there's no cases to be discussed.
Just tell Mr. Edge to call.
Mr. Orton, we'll meet downstairs, and we'll adjourn to closed session, and we'll return at 2 o'clock, so Madam Clerk doesn't have to be waiting here.
How long will we be there, Mr. Orton?
We can go upstairs.
15 minutes.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
4. Do I have permission to start, Madam Clerk? Thank you. With that, welcome back to August 15 meeting, the afternoon session. If council will report from closed session, report.
Mr. Chairman, the board met in closed session with its labor negotiator. No action was taken, so no reports required. Thank you.
And in your absence, the communications we had, there was no action taken. There won't be any report.
All right.
Isn't that what you wanted me to say?
Yes, I just wanted to clarify that the unrepresented employees, the labor negotiator for that, I stepped out of the office on that because our salary is linked to that.
Okay. Next item, Madam Clerk, C6. If you'll introduce that, please.
Certainly. Item C6 is a hearing to consider an appeal by J. Alex Benson of road improvement fee for property located in the community of Los Osos, 2nd District. Recommend item B withdrawn.
Thank you. Mr. Marshall?
Thank you, Supervisor Ashaji and members of the board. Richard Marshall, Department of Public Works. The clerk has received a letter from this appellant requesting the item be withdrawn, and that was received following the original scheduling of the item for public hearing. So we're here before you to present that recommendation that your board withdraw the item.
Thank you. Any other comments? Does anyone from the public wishes to comment on this item? Seeing none, bring it back to the board. Ms. Bianchi, it being in your district.
Staff's
recommendation
to withdraw the appeal.
Second.
Moved by Ms. Bianchi, seconded by Mr. Lentil. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it. And we do have a letter from Mr. Benson on file.
Correct.
The next item, please.
The next item is C7, a hearing to consider an appeal by the Sierra Club et al. And Landwatch San Luis Obispo County of the Planning Commission's decision to approve a development plan, coastal development permit, DRC 2004-00142, that would allow a three-phase geotechnical and hydrological data collection project to aid in the assessment of design alternatives for future saltwater or seawater desalination facility in the community of Cambria, 2nd District. Recommend denial of the appeal.
Thank you. Who would take the lead on this?
Martha Nieder, Martha. County Planning. Thank you, Chairman and members of the board. Here's a coming up on screen is a vicinity map of the project location, along with the land use category map and a site plan of the project. The CCSD provides potable water service to the community of Cambria and the State Park at San Simeon, the State Park campground at San Simeon State Beach. The CCSD has experienced water shortages in the past and has been under a water emergency since November of 2001. In order to provide a reliable water supply during the dry summer months and during drought periods, they're pursuing the completion of a seawater desalination project. The proposed three-phase data collection project, which is before you today, is to aid in the design alternatives for a future desal facility. The project was approved by the Planning Commission on June 22nd, and that decision was appealed by Sierra Club with Green Space in Mahala Burton and the Land Watch of San Luis Obispo County. The first appeal issue is that the project will impact public access and is inconsistent with public access policies. The project is proposing to use a Caltrans pullout here, which is used for parking, for a staging area and an access ramp, which the access ramp will be in place for approximately 1 month for the duration of the project. The staging area here is estimated to take up about 15 parking spaces of this larger parking area. Here's a photograph of the staging area. Here's where the access ramp would come down onto the beach. And then here's the larger parking area. While the project would displace approximately 15 informal parking spaces, there is area within that Caltrans pullout to accommodate the displaced parking. Also, on the weekend periods, the staging area, all of the equipment from the staging area would be removed to CCSD property. So when the parking area is more heavily used, they would remove the equipment from that area, although the access ramp would stay in place. Also, on the other side of Highway 1, there is a formalized parking area with bathrooms and a boardwalk which connects under the Highway 1 bridge to the beach, which would also be used. There would also be signs up in the Caltrans parking area notifying people of this alternative parking area. The Planning Commission did consider the potential impacts of the beach activities on the visitor experience to the beach, and they felt that any impact is temporary and insignificant. The second appeal issue is inconsistency with coastal plan policies as they relate to environmentally sensitive habitats. These policies generally require that any development within sensitive habitats does not significantly disrupt the resource and the resource is avoided to the greatest extent feasible. The purpose of the project is short-term and it's temporary data collection. Locations of the study are based on past geophysical work, so the study needs to occur in the places that the project is proposed to occur. The project has been designed to avoid sensitive resources to the greatest extent feasible while still meeting the objectives of the study. The third appeal issue is that there's no detailed scientific study or material provided that deals with the effects of ultrasound drilling and seismic reflection survey on the marine life. The applicant has submitted a technical memorandum by Carola Engineers, and they have also submitted an updated technical memorandum, which was distributed to your board members yesterday, and there's a couple extra copies in the front of the room. The CCSD proposes to install the mini sparker device encased in groundwater monitoring well, which is surrounded by saturated materials. So as sound travels through this material, it's actually lessened. And the decibels at the water interface is approximately going to be less than 60 decibels, which 60 decibels is equivalent to typical conversation levels. The memorandum concludes that the anticipated sound levels are well below agency accepted thresholds and they'll be safe for marine mammals. Although there's not expected to be any impact to marine life, there will be a marine wildlife monitor that will be watching for marine wildlife for behavioral activity or any changes in their activity. The fourth appeal issue is that the piecemealing of the project in CEQA compliance. There's kind of two thoughts raised in the appeals. One is that the study of the impact should be part of the larger desalination project, and or that separate permits should be issued for each phase of the proposed project. The proposed project is a collection of data to aid in the assessment of design alternatives for the future desal project, which will be subject to subsequent environmental review. The collection of this data does not predetermine the existence or the scope of that facility. The CCSD is the lead agency on the project, and they have issued a mitigated negative deck for the project on October 17th of 2005. The county, as the responsible agency, did participate in the CEQA process and provided comments to the CCSD on their proposed mitigated negative declaration. And pursuant to CEQA, the county, as a responsible agency, must consider the document legally adequate or litigate it within 30 days of their adoption. As far as the contention that each phase should be analyzed separately, when you look at the project, the overall project is a data collection project. So although there's three phases, it's three phases of one project, and there is enough information to analyze the impacts of the entire data collection project. The fifth appeal issue is that the project is in violation of Title VIII because phase three borings are for in preparation for the installation of pipelines that will discharge contaminants into ocean waters. The proposed data collection project will not result in the discharge of contaminants into the ocean waters or the placement of pipelines, and it will not place any pipes or conduits that can carry contaminants. The soil borings proposed as part of the project will provide data to develop design alternatives for a future project, will be subject to environmental review that will look at consistency with all adopted policies and regulations. The sixth appeal issue is that the Planning Commission made their decision on a misrepresentation of the purpose of the future desalination project and that the facility is designed to produce water for new urban development. Kamer has had a long-standing water supply shortage, and that's a matter of public record. The new water source is necessary to provide a reliable water source through the dry summer months and drought periods. The aquifers that the CCSD uses for the water supply are thin and narrow, and some of their wells have been contaminated with MTBE. Again, the CCSD has been under a water code emergency since November of 2001, and however the future plant is designed, environmental review must address the potential for the project to be growth-inducing and the related environmental impacts to that. The seventh appeal issue is that the project is not consistent with the general plan, local coastal program, or coastal plan policies. The Planning Commission found the project consistent with the general plan, local coastal program, and coastal plan policies, and the most relevant policies are discussed in your June 22nd Planning Commission staff report. Regardless of when these specific elements of the general plan or when the North Coast Area Plan were adopted, their policies and regulations are in effect, and the project is consistent with these. The final appeal issue is that the project is not adequately described, as it does not include an adequate description of the location of development. A detailed project description and the development location map have been provided. The proposed project has been adequately described, and there is enough information to analyze the project and the potential impacts of each phase. As the project's implemented, any change that would result in a less than anticipated impact would be considered consistent with the project. If there is a necessary change to the project that would have the potential to result in a greater impact, then the change would not be consistent with the project approval, and a new development plan and coastal development permit would be required. Your board did receive a letter from one of the appellants questioning the appropriateness of including a editorial from the newspaper in the staff report package. And while it's not an exact science in that we don't look through the papers every day for articles that relate to every project, we do try and include articles on projects, especially those in the coastal zone, which go on to the Coastal Commission, an agency that is not in the local area, to provide kind of the local, more of a local input on the projects and just give some more detail on to that agency as they analyze the project. In conclusion, staff recommends the approval of the development plan and coastal development permit be upheld and that the appeals be denied. This concludes staff's presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions for staff. Ms. Nieder or Ms. Griffin, when you speak to the sensitive habitat areas, you mentioned that the project's designed to minimize impacts. Were you referring to this particular project, the data collection project, or the bigger project?
The data collection project.
Okay, and do you have someone on site to see that there is minimal damage or minimal impact to any sensitive habitat areas? And are there sensitive habitat areas within the proximity of this project?
There are numerous sensitive habitats in proximity of the project, and the project is conditioned to have an environmental monitor that is approved by the county, really an extension of county staff monitoring the project. Okay. So they will be on site.
Okay. And then relative to the issues regarding the segmenting of the environmental impact report or the project and CEQA review, and also you talked about the worst-case scenarios. The project was considered four worst-case scenarios in order to be a comprehensive analysis, and if anything changes, then a new permit would be required. How is that process undertaken, and who determines if there has been a deviation from the original project and an additional permit would be required? How does that process work?
It could work in a number of ways, and it depends on how it's brought to our attention. For example, if the applicant in doing further design on where they're going to collect the data finds that they need to drill in other locations, they would bring it to our attention. Or by having the county monitor out on site, if the county monitor sees something that raises a question of whether this is consistent with the approved project, they would bring that to our attention. And that's a planning department determination on whether the impacts would be greater and require a new permit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none? Okay, thank you. This is an appeal. We'll start with the appellant. We'll give the appellant 10 minutes to do the introduction, then we'll have you come back for 5 minutes to your closing remarks. After the appellant, we'll go to the applicant for 10 minutes introduction, and 5 minutes afterwards for closing remarks, and the public at large will have 3 minutes each. This is an appeal by Sierra Club and the Land Watch. If you want to come together or one at a time, please come forward and give us your name for the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Cynthia Hawley here representing Land Watch, San Luis Obispo County. And first, does each appellant get 10 minutes or is it 10 minutes?
Okay. No. Appellant as one body gets 10 minutes. You can get 10 minutes yourself. No. You're together, mm-hmm. and we're going to give you 10 minutes together.
Okay.
Now, if there's a questions from my colleagues that will bring you back and ask those questions, then that doesn't count for or against your time. But at the end, you'll have 5 minutes to rebut and or do your closing remarks.
Okay. Thank you. And I'll take five, and then Sierra Club can have five.
If that's your choice,
yeah.
You're welcome to do so.
Oh, good. So I'm not going to go through every single issue on our appeal. I just want to bring to your attention that four of the issues that we raised weren't addressed at all. And what I'd like to talk about is three different things. First, the project needs to be understood that it's not isolated from DSAL. You may be able to find the rationale to separate this out from the, looking at the whole project at one time, but the project is not separate from DSAL. It's the first step in the construction of major infrastructure for a public works project that is going to provide water for growth. And I'm not saying that the project is going to be growth-inducing. No, the purpose of the project is going to be to provide water for growth. That brings me to the second issue, and that's the misinformation. Even today, staff reiterated the misinformation that the DSAL is for drought. We have water, other water supplies that could be used for drought. The reason that DSAL is being selected is because DSAL has the capacity to provide basically for unlimited water for growth. And the second misinformation issue is that the district is not issuing any new hookups. The district has continued to issue hookups since the moratorium, since the water shortage emergency was established, and they have, at that time, I believe there were 140 pieces of property or hookups that were in the pipeline. They decided that after they established the moratorium, they'd allow a certain number to go through, and I believe that's 140 in the building, and the hookups still go on in Cambria. Now, I'd like to get to what's happening here with the planning situation, and staff touched on it in relation to your legal inability to be able to make a finding of consistency with the general plan or with any general plan element in relation to this project, because the general plan itself, the North Coast Area Plan, is outdated. It's completely dysfunctional and antiquated. It hasn't been rewritten entirely since 1981 when it was first written by the county. That's the last comprehensive establishment of any standards, any policies, any goals, any combining designations, any maps of resources, any assessment of the availability and capacity of resources. The last time that was undertaken on a comprehensive level was 1981. The Coastal Commission acknowledged this in 1997 when the Coastal Commission said that we desperately needed a new update at that time. Now, it will be what LandWatch commented on to you and to your staff was that legally it's impossible for you to make a finding of consistency. The courts have held that where there is an area plan or any part of a general plan or any element of a general plan that doesn't exist or is not functional as a useful planning tool, because the general plan is a planning tool, then it's impossible to make a finding of consistency. The same situation exists with the conservation element, and I understand that the county is updating the conservation element right now. But until the conservation element is in place with all of the needed water information and the mapping that will be in that document, until the North Coast Area Plan is in place with the mapping, the standards, the combining designations that address current population issues, current traffic issues, the mapping of wetlands has not been done there. Until that happens, you don't have a planning tool for the context, the foundation for saying whether or not this is consistent with your planning tools or not. Basically, what's happening here is that there's no planning tool at all. And in the absence of these two important elements, the North Coast Area Plan, which is the land use element and also the circulation element, and in absence of a conservation element, you're flying by the seat of your pants, and there's really no planning going on at all. What we would like for you to do is to deny this permit, and even though it's illegal for you to issue a permit for anything in the North Coast Area Plan because you don't have an area plan that's adequate, at least don't issue permits for something that is associated with a major public works project that will be an infrastructure that will provide for growth. It's my understanding that the DSAL that is planned will be planned in such a way that it can be added onto in the future. Basically, it's an open-ended water pipeline. And we're asking you today to not give this permit based on the reasons that we gave. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, supervisors.
Good afternoon, sir.
My name's Jack Morrow. I live in Cambria. I am today representing the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club as a member of their executive committee. I'm also chair of the Cambria Desalination Task Force, an organization that includes members from all segments in Cambria's population, including the Cambria Community Services District, and which has worked together for more than a year now in an effort to ensure proper environmental safeguards in the desalination project for Cambria. I would like to emphasize that our position today, as expressed in our written comments to the Planning Commission and to our written appeal and in our written appeal documents to the Board, can be summarized in stating that we believe an environmental impact report should be required in lieu of the proposed mitigated negative declaration. We feel this would remove all controversy in this matter, would be beneficial to the environment, and would not be an onerous requirement for the CCSD and its contractors. Our reason for asking for an EIR are as follows. First, no definitive study has been made of the environmental risks involved, nor an inventory made of the species of plant and animal life involved in this project, which is within a state park and within the Monterey National Marine Sanctuary. There was not even a listing of these prepared to assess the risks and level of risk to the environment. This would have been required in an EIR. Our second reason is that this project is clearly a feasibility study for both beach wells and a connecting pipeline, and thus is an integral part of the entire desalinization proposal. Since all parties, we believe, acknowledge that an EIR would be a requirement of the total project, this study, which involves alterations of the environment, should logically require an EIR. This contention is legally supported by California Environmental Quality Act and the court decisions flowing from that act. To quote from one such court decision, and I quote, CEQA requires that the lead agency, through its initial study, review the whole of a project. A project must not be broken into smaller parts, each of which alone might qualify for a negative declaration in an attempt to avoid preparing an EIR. That's from the Association for Sensible Development of Bishop Area versus County of Inyo, 1985, end of quote. We therefore request that the Board of Supervisors require the preparation of an environmental impact report before granting permission for this project to proceed. Thank you, and thanks for granting us this hearing.
Thank you. Okay.
My name is Mahala Burton. I'm a Cambria resident. I've lived in own property in the county for about 35 years.
Ms. Burton, you can continue what's left here, or I can give you as a public, if you, can you hold on to time, 3 minutes? So,
well, 3 minutes, is that what I have?
If you want to speak as a public...
I'm an appellant.
You're an appellant. Okay, we'll give you the remainder of the time. I was just trying to give you more time in different ways. Okay. We have under 1 minute, 27 seconds.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, well, I agree with everything my colleagues have said, and since I can't say very much, this is, I believe in history and that we can learn the lessons of history. This drilling was proposed once before. It's State Parks land. It is not a Caltrans pullout. That happens to be State Parks land with a staging area. Here are the maps from Caltrans. I did some research on that. This was completely denied back in 94. From 93 to 94, the CCSD tried to get this drilling project, and State Parks just said absolutely not, and it was appealed all the way to Sacramento. And it's the director in Sacramento said, it is the mission of the Department of Parks and Recreation to provide recreational opportunities and resource protection to the benefit of all Californians. This mission is consistent with the highest uses of the Coastal Act. I can provide copies to you of all this documentation of why this exact project. And the project now is far larger. It's a gargantuan project. A little project was denied because it's state park land. It belongs to the public for recreation. It isn't an industrial area. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. At this time, we'll go to the applicant, and you'll have 10 minutes total. How many speakers in your group?
Just a few.
Just a few.
Just
so
me and the district engineer, and if there's any questions, we have our team of experts.
Okay, so you'll have total 10 minutes.
That's fine.
If you'll give us your name for the record, please.
Certainly. I'm the general manager for the Cambria Community Services District. My name is Tammy Rudock. We're here today to provide you with a brief presentation to be here mostly for any questions that you might have regarding our coastal development permit for the geotechnical feasibility investigation. I want to introduce the fact that we have our board president, Peter Shaldicott, here today. Art Montandon, our district legal counsel, is available. And I will introduce Bob Gressens. As you well know, he's our district engineer, and he will make the brief presentation and introduce our team of engineering and technical and permitting experts. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy. Thank you, Mr. President, members of the board. Appreciate the time you're offering us. I have a brief presentation I'll go through, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have at the appropriate point. Before I start, though, I'd like to introduce our technical team that's here with me in case some more detailed questions come up. We have Dave Kraska of Corello Engineers. He is a partner with the firm and also our project manager. We have Mr. Eric Snelling with Padre Associates, and Eric is a senior environmental planner. We also have Mr. Paul Sorensen with Fugro, and he's a principal geohydrologist. And at that, I'll just jump into the presentation. Next slide. Okay. This project is basically a data collection effort. And by that, our data is needed on the subterranean conditions in order to develop alternatives for a future EIR that we plan to do on the desalination project. So this will help us do a better job on an EIR in the future. The alternatives developed from the data collected will undergo a separate and detailed environmental analysis and a public review process. So this is just to get the data to help support that effort of developing the EIR. The CDP issued to us is for data collection and not for the actual data desalination project. And just to emphasize, there are no permanent facilities that are being constructed as part of this effort. The work is short-term and will occur during the off-peak tourist season. We'll maintain the public access to the beach area. The potential impacts from the actual work will be mitigated by avoidance and monitoring measures, and we'll leave the area in its natural state when we're finished. Next slide, please. I'll just be very brief here. I know we have three phases of the work. Basically, phase one is 7 4-inch diameter soil borings at parallel to the beach area. We have cone penetrometer testing, which is about a 1 to 2-inch diameter probe that gets pushed into the sand. Then there's a temporary access ramp to allow the equipment on and off the beach. The phase two work is 2 4-inch diameter groundwater monitoring wells and a seismic reflection survey. Phase three is pumping, is a pumping test of short duration, 1 to possibly 3 days max, of the groundwater in the monitoring wells. And then there's some inland soil borings. At the end of the collection of our data, we'll fill the wells and abandon them and restore the areas, as mentioned before. Next slide. We have adopted mitigation measures that are now part of the conditions of approval of the project, the main point being that we have at least 17 biological mitigation measures that our board adopted last October on this project, 3 cultural resource mitigation measures, 1 geological mitigation measure, a hazardous spill measure, and 3 wastewater mitigation measures that we plan to follow. Next slide. This just illustrates that our beach access will be maintained. There are 2 parking lots in the area. The one to the east of the actual Highway 1 has a boardwalk that allows access to the beach, and there's a restroom. And that existing day-use parking lot will not be impacted and will remain open at all times. There's also a seasonal plover nesting area that we need to avoid, which requires us to do our work during the off-peak season because of the way those birds happen to nest and lay their eggs. So we're out there during the off-peak tourist season due to the birds that are out there that we have to avoid. The west parking area off of Highway 1, the lower southern half is where we have the ramp for our equipment, and we estimate the half, approximately half of that parking lot will be closed for about 25 working days during normal hours. The next slide, please, is the our sound levels are mitigated, as Martha mentioned. The subterranean sounds that are generated by both the drilling and the mini sparker testing are reduced to below the background levels at the surf zone. The sounds generated above ground will be mitigated as well. The sound levels are below or substantially below those cited by references for potential impacts to marine life and as well as fish. Then the biological monitoring will further ensure the impacts are not occurring. And that's with our biologist who will be out there in the field checking this. And we could certainly work with the county's person as well. The next slide is basically you've seen. I won't spend a lot of time on it other than the fact that our updated seismic attenuation study showed that there's approximately 45 decibels maximum that would come from this equipment at the interface. And that's a very quiet noise. Just to give you a feel for that, that's roughly the sound of a very high-quality dishwashing machine that's very well sound insulated. And that's as maximum noise that this would generate at that closest point with the ocean interface. Finally, our concluding comments is just we have no permanent facilities are being constructed as part of this effort. The work is short-term duration. It avoids the peak tourist season, and we maintain public access. The data will support decisions made in order for us to do a better job on the desalination project EIR-EIS, which we plan to follow, and that will have a separate public review and environmental clearance process. The adopted measures for this scientific data gathering effort will protect the environment. We're through mainly the avoidance of any impacts of sensitive areas and species and the monitoring. We're going to leave the area in its natural state when we're done, and we support your staff's recommended action. So that will close, and we'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. You much. Before you leave, Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. What facilities are proposed should the data that you're collecting indicate that this is a good site? What would actually be constructed there as a permanent facility?
As part of this CDP, I want to make sure I understand the context.
No, the question is, should data gathered at this particular site prove positive and you develop a desal plant, what facilities would be constructed at that site, if any?
At this point, we don't know. I mean, that's part of what we have to write into our EIR. We would be looking at various alternatives. It may be three or four different approaches that we'd have to develop. In order to answer your question, we look at what would have the least environmental impact in order to tell you. At this point, I do not know until we gather this data and we sit down and start working on our actual EIR for the project. So I hate to be evasive, but I can't tell you. The only thing that we're putting now are the two groundwater monitoring wells, and those will be removed at the end of the project.
Are you looking at any other sites currently or just this one?
Right now, we're just looking at, we've assessed several alternatives for water supply over the years. But as far as the potential for desalination, there was some assessment work done back in the mid to late 1990s that's called geophysical exploration, where you walk along the surface and you could kind of get some crude measurements on the depth of the alluvial material down to the bedrock. And at that point, they looked at about three different areas. And this was probably the deepest subsurface or subterranean strata of that past work. It looked the most promising at that point in time.
Are you familiar with the information that Ms. Burton offered regarding state parks' refusal back in 1994 to allow the construction of a desal plant at that location?
I haven't looked at that specific data that she just held up. I'd be glad to look at it in detail. And to my knowledge, it was a totally different project back in that time frame, and there were concerns about environmental impacts and so forth. I don't know the specifics of state parks' concerns at that time without studying that record.
Okay, and has state parks given their blessing to move forward with this project?
We've been working with state parks. They did have a representative at the Planning Commission hearing on June 22nd.
Mr. Cicero is here.
Oh, okay.
You probably haven't seen him.
To speak on that. We have been in discussions with state parks, and to date, it seems like we are making good progress, provided we have the proper mitigations in place.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Bianchi?
No, I was going to ask Mr. Cicero if he wanted to make a statement. Does anybody have any questions of state parks?
If they,
not.
Thank you. Mr. Lentil?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask County Council, because the comment was made earlier here about the legality of this board making a decision or rendering a decision. And the other question is our area plan adequate?
I think that the board has an adopted area plan that has not been ruled to be inadequate, and I think it's sufficient for you to proceed with. There's granted the conservation element is being updated, and it's old, but they're still part of the general plan. And so I don't see a legal problem with proceeding.
Thank you.
Ms. Bianchi?
On that issue, don't we have... Martha could probably answer this question. We have a Cambria-San Simeon update to the general plan, which I believe we've approved and is at the Coastal Commission.
Correct.
And heaven only knows how long that will last.
You need to say that for your final remarks, not now. No, ma'am. We go to the public first. Okay. I have a few requests to speak. The first request is Mike Dill, followed by Peter Chaldicott? Is that what it is? Peter's last name.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Dill.
Chaldicott.
I'm a member of United Lot Owners of Cambria, and I'm a resident of Paso Robles. For 6.5 years, we've been coming before you and asking for your help and assistance. It's been since 2000, actually, since they actually have released any numbers at all of new building permits. The ones that the one applicant mentioned are strictly ones that are in the pipeline, and it's been 6.5 years and they haven't went through those yet. The CCSD has made leaps and bounds moves toward helping solve the water situation and the water problem. They have established, I'm sure you know in the news, a lot retirement reduction plan. A maximum number build-out. So this is not open build-out of homes, as one applicant mentioned. This is limited growth. It was amazing to hear that the main topic on their concern was reducing the public access, and that for 1 month only. And if you listened to the Planning Commission meeting with a 4-1 vote to go forth with this, the one main concern was some poor person would be on vacation for a month or plan all year and come on vacation for a week and see drilling rigs on the beach and just ruin their vacation, when this whole project is to help the public in Cambria of the much-needed fire protection and the backup water system and the water safety for they have needed for so long. Yes, it is going to open the door to growth, but it's going to be limited growth. and everyone is in favor of this. The majority of the public, the CCSD, the members, everyone that we talk to is for the first time in 6.5 years is willing to move forward and to make great strides in making these decisions. I just can't comprehend sometimes the thinking of these people, why they don't consider the overall picture. They talk about saving the forest and saving the trees, but yet they want to stop the building of this desalinization for fire protection. The fire department has stated if they had a two-structure fire, they don't have enough water or water pressure or a backup water system to save anything beyond that. What would happen if they had a major fire in their area? But here they have a chance to move forward in the next few years and to have that there and to protect the pine forest. But no, it's just let's stop growth at all costs for the safety and the consideration of the public. I ask for your support in the staff recommendation and deny the appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chaldicott, followed by Roger Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Peter Chaldicott, and I'm currently president of Cambria Community Services District. And on behalf of my fellow directors, I wish that you would deny the appeal. I would also like to tell you that as a board, we are committed to environmentally responsible projects. Cambria is an environmentally sensitive habitat, as we found out. And so everything we do has an environmental content, and we are very aware of what we have to do and what we can't do and what we shouldn't do. And we're trying to do the right thing, and I think you see from the report from our staff that's what we're trying to do. I would like to clarify two remarks by the appellant. One was that there is additional water available. There is not additional water available. If there was, we would go and find it. There are just two creeks, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Santa Rosa and San Simeon, and as it happens, with the changing face in agriculture, there's a shift from, I guess, what they used to call dry farming to vineyards and avocados, all of which require watering year in, year out. And the farmers doing that are doing it well within their riparian rights. We don't wish to stop them doing that. But it does mean there's less water downstream for us in the future. So the desal is going to be very essential in drought periods. The second thing I'd like to say, because I've been on the board for some time, the previous project in the 90s was approximately three times the size of the one we're planning right now. So in other words, this is not a gargantuan project. This is a third of the size of the one that was planned in the 90s. Additionally, the one in the 90s required us to build a concrete tower out in the ocean and collect water from there. And that was an environmentally questionable project because we never sure that what would happen to the tower, so we didn't pursue that. But the project we have, I say, is considerably less than that, so the term gargantuan did kind of upset me because it has no relationship to the truth. That's all I wish to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, followed by Ron Cromit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm Roger Anderson. I live in Morro Bay, but I probably am somewhat familiar with desal. Morro Bay has a desal plant which is used for a supplemental water source. I've, in my time served in Morro Bay, become very familiar with historical rainfall numbers in the county of San Luis Obispo. Normal is a mythical number. And if you go back and look at 100-year records, very seldom is average rainfall what we get. We either get a lot or we get little. And to say that Cambria has an adequate water source is, I think, stretching things a bit, especially during drought years. Very recently, there have been periods of time where Cambrians were asked to reduce their consumption drastically. And how many times through the years in various communities other than Cambria, Morro Bay certainly, and Cayucas, have we heard the statement made, if we have another year of drought like the one we just went through, we're going to have very serious problems. Fortunately, in the last few decades, that hasn't come to pass. But, you know, the miracle march of, 12 or 15 years ago, things have always, we've gotten bailed out. But if you go back and look at a 100-year record of rainfall, you'll see that longer periods of drought can and probably will again occur. I think that looking at a supplemental water source to ensure Cambrians adequate water is a good thing to do to move forward and investigate this. I guess the statement I'd like to make is that the idea of growth was brought up, and growth can be controlled by methods other than not taking care of water and sewer needs. If you want to control growth, there are legal ways to limit growth and yet move forward with needed water service or sewer service, as the case may be, in communities. But too often these methods are used to stop or at least temporarily stop growth. And there are other ways that can do that that don't end up increasing the cost of these general front fund projects that eventually have to be done anyway. I would encourage you to look carefully at this, because especially after the MTBE contamination in Cambria, there needs to be another supplemental water source. Limit growth by some other means if that's what you wish to do. Thank you.
Ron Cromit.
Good afternoon. Well, it seems like a number of the speakers have...
Want to give us your name for the record,
My
please.
Name is Ron Crummett. I've been Thank a you. Resident of Cambria for 26 years. Seems like a number of the speakers have stolen my thunder already with some of the things I wanted to say, but I'll go ahead with it. First off, the purpose of this project is not for growth. It's really, like the other gentleman said, for fire protection. This is the desal plant is an additional water source supply to help us if we, good Lord, ever get into a situation like some of the southern fires that has just happened recently. We also have a way of limiting our growth. I was privileged to be on a committee with a plan that developed the build-out reduction plan for Cambria, limiting the growth of the lots of Cambria to approximately 4,500. We have 3,800 units now already. This would limit it to that area, including the new 650 people that are on the water list now. So no matter how big an additional water source may be, there's only so many lots that you can build on, and that in itself will limit the growth. Limiting the growth has been a long, long argument from our opposition, and they don't seem to get anything else new. This is another tactic to delay, stall, and block what's something that should be done right and should be done for the benefit of all Cambrians. Studies are good when they happen, but when do the studies end? When does action take place? Your staff even said that this particular project is just a part of the overall plan, not the overall plan. It is the data collection project, and I would urge that you vote with your staff and deny the appeal that's before you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Ross' request to speak from the public. At this time, we'll go back to the applicant and we'll come to the appellant. Ms. Rudock or Mr. Gissing, either one of you have any remarks or closing remarks or rebuttal?
Actually, no, we'll be brief. We'll be glad to answer any questions you might have remaining in your minds. We're standing by with our technical team. So we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This time we'll go to the appellant. If either one of you want to start, Ms. Holly, we have 5 minutes total.
Thank you. Cynthia Holly with Landwatch, San Luis Obispo County. First, I wanted to respond to Supervisor Bianchi's comments about the North Coast Area Plan. No, it's not the North Coast Area Plan. It's at the Coastal Commission.
I think it's the Cambria-San Simeon section.
The Cambria-San Simeon section of it. It's been broken apart. The huge area that is the open space of the North Coast Area Plan has not been updated since 1981 comprehensively. And that's the area, the North Coast area, is the area in which the DSAL project and this exploratory project is taking place or is proposed to take place. I want to point out that the build-out reduction plan has not been adopted. It's not something that is a for-sure thing, and I don't even believe that they've made any selection. You can correct me if I'm wrong as to how many lots they're going to buy up or what their target is. I don't think that's been decided yet. I think they have a committee that's going to be deciding that. I want to point out, for those who mentioned it, Mr. Anderson and Mr. Crummett also, maybe Mr. Anderson didn't, but that DSAL is not for fire. We're not going to be pushing seawater through a membrane fast enough to pump to fight a fire. Our need for firefighting is through storage, and I think that all these folks here realize that and know that firefighting is in our town is a problem of storage. We have not only the CSD has a fire department and CDF has a fire department, and they're building storage tanks for that now. We don't use all our allocated water. We could pump more water from the creeks in the wintertime, and that's one of the things that I want to also clarify is that Mr. Chaldicott said that I spoke about additional water, and Mr. Anderson mentioned adequate water. What I was talking about is that a water source. I'm not saying that we don't need water for drought. I'm saying that the source for drought doesn't need to be desal. We also, and I don't believe that we've adopted our water management plan yet or our analysis of all the sources, and I don't think we've even had an environmental impact report on the analysis of all the sources that we're looking at, even though we're going straight on ahead with desal. For years, people have been trying to promote the idea of watershed enhancement through the proliferation of stock ponds in Santa Rosa and San Simeon Creek so that during drought seasons, the creeks' valleys would hold more water. We have also had an opportunity to build a reservoir and pump extra water that we don't use during the wintertime and store it for the summertime. So I wasn't talking about additional water, that we don't need additional water or that we have adequate water. I've lived through droughts there, and I know what it's like. It's going to be about four times worse this next time. The idea that planning is going to put a cap on growth once there's unlimited resources is wrong. I believe that no one could ever point to any area that's been where growth has been controlled by planning. And especially in this case, when the North Coast does not have an area plan that will protect against growth, not just in Cambria, not just in San Simeon, but outside those areas. And I realize that there's an initiative that's being promoted by the district that would prohibit them or from the district from pumping water outside of the district. But I believe that there are holes in that. The district is planning to put it on the next ballot, and they have not done any CEQA. I think that it's challengeable in more ways than one. So that's not a sure bet either. I'm not just worried about Cambria and San Simeon. I'm worried about the North Coast area and the water that this desal plant will be able to produce to provide for urban sprawl in the North Coast. And with that in mind, this is a project that will be growth-inducing for that area. And without the North Coast area plan to determine how that growth will occur, we have no business approving. This board has no legal business approving a growth-inducing project, infrastructure for the North Coast area at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay. Close to the public at this time and bring it back to the supervisors for further discussion and or possible motion. Ms. Bianchi.
Yeah, well, I'd like to respond to some statements. Since I've spent the last 25 years of my life trying to prevent the North Coast area from sprawling anywhere, and that would include everything north of Via Creek, and then, of course, the last 16 years, you know, the rest of the North Coast, particularly in the Cambria area, Cambria cannot grow to the north because to the north, we have state parks, we have conservation easements. We can't grow directly to the east because the Covell Ranch is under a conservation easement. It cannot grow to the southeast because the Williams property is under a conservation easement. The only place it might grow, it might squish out the southeast corner, but that property is under Williamson Act contract at the moment, so it can't particularly go that direction either. And to the direct south on the north coast is the Sibley, it's not the Sibley Ranch, Rancho Marino, I think it's now called, and the Air Force housing area, so old Air Force housing. So by having all of those conservation easements, and I worked on those deliberately, because there's no better way to keep something from developing than put it into conservation easement in perpetuity, because I know the vagaries of the political system in this county. I really do want to make one comment about agriculture. It's not necessarily the agriculture that limits the amount of water that can be taken out of the creeks. It's the State Water State Water Board, used to be State Water Resources Control Board, has limited the amount of water that the district can pump out of the two creeks in the dry season. That's what limits the amount of water that comes out of the creeks. And unfortunately, when the MTBE spill came forward, I guess is a good way of phrasing it, when the knowledge of it came forward, that cut the supply for Cambria water supply by one-third. And that's a huge chunk of water to take out of a community that's limited anyway. This is a catch-22, in a sense, that you can't design a project without data. And there's no way to get the data if you have to design the entire project before you have the data. And so, this is, in my mind, this project is data acquisition. Data acquisition alone. And if the community needs to have that information, and it's sort of like the first step on a journey that was stated, it's this first step on the journey to more growth. Well, oftentimes, if you go on a journey and you don't step down correctly with the information that you have, with good information, you're liable to break your leg. And if you break your leg, you don't go ahead with the journey. And I see this data acquisition as being that first step. You need the information before you can go ahead. And believe me, I don't think that if the district tried to go ahead with the siting of the desal plant and with the building of the desal plant somewhere without going through the environmental process, neither the public nor the county would stand for that. It wouldn't simply not be allowed. I'm looking at Mr. Ufrat like he could wave a magic wand, but I mean, it would be nice if you could. I support this project mainly because it is data acquisition, and if the data isn't there, the project, the desal project will not go forward. If it is, the desal project has to go through the environmental review process. I may not be in the board at that time, but I can certainly still come down and yell. I've never been known as yelling quietly, Mrs. Rabbit.
If that was a motion, I'll second it. I want to make sure it was a motion.
That's a motion.
I'll second it.
We have a motion and a second, if Madam Clerk got
for
that
staff
motion.
Staff recommendations?
Yes.
I believe so. Moved by Supervisor Bianchi, seconded by Supervisor Lentil. A roll call, please.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mr. Lentil?
Aye.
Mr. Ovitt?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye. Thank you. That concludes today's meeting. So we're adjourned.
Bye. Have a safe trip.
I don't want to put words to you.
Well, I haven't quite made it yet.